House Civil Law Committee will come to order. Can I get a motion on the minutes? Minutes have been moved. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you. First bill up is House File 1112, and Representative Winkler is not here yet, but Bert Black is here. Mr. Black, would you be willing to begin comments on the bill, and we can finish up when Representative Winkler gets here.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, members. My name is Bert Black. I'm the legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State. And House File 1112 is every couple of years we're here with a smorgasbord of suggestions for improvement in the business entity and lien filing laws, and this year is no exception. And I can tell you that there are 10 sections here, 10 mighty sections. We're trying to harmonize, conform, clarify, streamline, and otherwise improve our business entities law. I can also tell you that we have shared this text with the business law section of the State Bar and with the Cooperative Network, and we have heard no objections, and they've had it for well over a month. There are three sections here which address the question of data practices, and I would like to go over those first. The other seven sections are the exciting sections in this bill, Mr. Chairman.
We're not interested in anything exciting here, Mr. Black. This is the Civil Law Committee.
Right. Section one is an amendment to a law that we worked on with Representative Holberg in 2009. And it allows us to use email addresses that businesses give us to provide their official notices. At the time, we were only doing paper filings, and so it only addresses paper submissions. The law allows the customer to keep their email address as non-public for bulk data sales if they check a box. We now have digital equivalents of that, and so we'd like to extend that to the digitally created documents. And then there's some clarifying language that indicates that if you ask for the information of a particular company, so if you ask for the filings for ABC Corporation, and that's on there, that that will be given to you. The theory being that if you have, if you're asking for those copies, you probably need to get a hold of that company. Sections 9 and 10, and by the way, there is a bill summary in your packet. Also in your packet are some materials that address sections 9 and 10, which are the other data practices issues. And these are two forms, one old, one new, that are used for Uniform Commercial Code financing statements. In 2010, we came to you and asked that the Social Security number and the taxpayer identification number, which had previously been public in our hands, and that was sort of a non-conforming use for the Social Security number, that they be made private. The Social Security number is still going to be private. We asked for the taxpayer identification number to be made private at that time because on the old form, if you look at box 1D, that is the box where both the SSN and the TIN were placed. And it just seemed like a good idea at the time to just not have to try to interpret which is which because they're both nine-digit numbers. Mm-hmm. In 2011, the Uniform Law Commissioners came out with a number of changes in Article 9, which the legislature enacted and which will go into effect this July 1st. One of the changes, if you look at the new form, is that the SSN and the taxpayer information number field is gone. We don't want that information. We never really have wanted that information. But it's gone. And so the taxpayer identification number, frankly, it's all over the place. It's on your W-2. It's on the 990s. The IRS sells it, and you can get it online for a nominal fee, of course. And so we'd like that to be made go back to its previous status of public, because, frankly, that would streamline the provision of UCC copies greatly. The other sections of the bill, Mr. Chairman and members, let's go back to chronological order. Section 2 changes the...
Mr. Black, yeah. Are these the non-data sections?
These are the non-data sections.
Okay, well, I don't think we're interested in going through all of those.
You've got the bill summary, and they're all kind of boring.
Okay. Questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, then Representative Winkler moves that House File 1112 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Mr. Black, for your testimony. Welcome, Representative Winkler. Are you prepared on House File 283?
I am, Mr. Chair. I would recommend it to pass and be re-referred to...
General Register.
The General Register.
And you have an A13 amendment, Representative Winkler?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
And do you have
I would move the A13.
On this, Representative Winkler?
No, I move the A13 amendment.
Okay, Representative Winkler moves the A13 amendment in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, Mr. Representative Winkler, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, members, there is a very basic rule of evidence that says if the parties are agreeing to mediate or try to settle their dispute without the involvement of the court directly, any information they share with each other should not be admissible in court later to be used against them. It's a rule that allows, or that is designed to encourage parties to settle and not use up court time. House File 283 basically just expands that rule a little bit to a collaborative law process, which is basically a... it's a dispute resolution method that was put together by the Uniform Laws Commission. So this is a fairly straightforward, simple expansion of that concept of that privilege.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. Do you have any testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Are there questions first from members before I take... why don't we do... Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify either in favor or in opposition to House File 283? Questions from members of the committee? Okay, then Representative Winkler has moved that House File 283 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register as amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes.
Gee whiz.
Representative Winkler, to your next, do you have another, what's our calendar here? You have House File 1058. Are you prepared on that, Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd recommend that House File 1058, or I move that House File 1058 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Education Finance.
Okay. Representative Winkler moves that House File 1058 be recommended to pass. Did you say Education Finance, Representative Winkler?
That's correct.
Okay. And you don't have any amendments, so we don't have any amendments pre-filed. So to your bill, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, members, this is the Early Childhood Scholarships Bill, the Many Minds Bill, that has been put together with a host of advocates and people who are focused on improving the learning opportunities for Minnesota's youngest children and its at-risk children. This bill passed out of the Early Childhood Policy Committee unanimously. And there are just a couple of provisions that relate to data, and that's the reason for the stop here. I would direct your attention to lines 3.19 to 3.21, which requires a child who receives a scholarship for an early childhood program to complete their development screening, which is required for all children. And basically, the reason this is a data issue is that when that screening is completed, the child is assigned a MARS number that the Department of Education uses to track students. So is basically putting that in place for now. If students don't get this at their screening, they will get it when they become kindergartners anyway. And so the idea here is that you create more accountability for these early childhood programs by assigning a MARS number when they are starting out in this program. I would also then refer you to page 4, lines 4.7 to 4.14, which is subdivision 11. And this relates to data that is collected by the director of the Office of Early Learning pursuant to this program. The families have to fill out an application which contains some basic information about the child. And this allows the director of the Office of Early Learning, which is at the Department of Education, to basically aggregate some of that data. And it also, this paragraph contains language requiring any of the early childhood providers to keep data that they collect confidential and mirrors language in the Data Practices Act. That is the reason why this bill is here, and I would ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. Do you have any other testifiers to your bill? Are there members of the audience who wish to be heard on House File 1058? Questions from members? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler. We have lots of current law around student records, et cetera. What elements of data are you collecting that aren't already classified under current law?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, if you go to page 2.36 and then just over to the next line, 3.1, the language says that the director may prioritize applications on factors including family income, geographic location, and the needs of the child. That is the kind of information that will be collected. And it may be that the language in 4.10 that says that it's private as pursuant to the Data Practice Act, that middle section of that paragraph may be extraneous. But the other language about the provider needing to hold that information confidential, that is not currently in the Data Practices Act as applied to those individual, or as opposed to the... as applied to those providers. So I think that language is necessary. But otherwise, I don't think this information gathering is so different from what we would gather in any other educational context.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what it means, must treat the identification numbers in a confidential manner. I mean, we usually just classify data, and if it was classified as confidential, it wouldn't be available to the participant. And I'm not, I don't know what you're saying there. I mean, I think we just want them to follow the law. And so I don't know if that's just confusing, because I don't know what a confidential manner is under Chapter 13.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I think the issue is that the participating program is not necessarily a public program. These could be family home-based child care programs that are licensed. It could be, the YMCA. It could be a church-based program. So these aren't public entities who are collecting the information from the families. And so that's why, and I think Mr. Guerin can speak to this, this section at least was, I didn't discuss it directly, but he discussed it with one of the advocates, that this language applying these standards to the private sector providers is probably a good idea and would not necessarily be captured under the Data Practices Act. If you have a different opinion about that, I'd be more than happy to fix that up.
Mr. Chair, I'd be interested to see what Mr. Gearing says, but it's kind of in some ways going back to the library issue that I'm guessing there's going to be some type of a contract between the government entity and the providers, whether they be private entities or not, and would thus be subject to Chapter 13 provisions. So,
well, and Mr. Guerin, why don't you,
Winkler? Yeah, I'd just like to address the question of the contract. I'm not, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I'm not certain that there actually would be a contract. The way this program works is that to be eligible, the programs have to be rated based on quality, and then the scholarship basically tracks the child, but the state makes the payment directly to the provider based on whether the child is there. So I'm not sure that there actually is going to be a contractual relationship. It's not like a human services provider where they are contracting out state services. So I'm not sure that there actually would be a contract.
Representative Holberg or Mr. Guerin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, that the way Representative Winkler described it is the way I understood it from talking with the advocates yesterday, that the participating program providers may or may not be a public school, and there will be private schools involved as well, and there's not a contract in the way that the Data Practices Act kind of contemplates a contract between a government entity and a private program. So some language about how those programs have to classify and handle the data is probably appropriate in the bill. Whether or not it's written the right way is kind of a policy choice, but there probably should be something in there.
Representative Holbert?
Mr. Chair, just to be clear then, is your intent of that language treat the student identification numbers in a confidential manner, that they treat them in a matter as dictated by Chapter 13?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, that would be my intention, that the providers would have to follow the same standards for data privacy that a public entity would.
And so, if I might,
Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, it's not your intent that you're classifying the data as confidential. In other words, the providers could give information to individuals about themselves that's held in the record.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, yes, I would expect so. And I don't think this is going to be information that the individuals wouldn't know themselves, like where they live and what their family income is and things like that.
Representative Holbrook.
Well, again, Mr. Chair, words matter, and I'm just trying to figure out what you're trying to do here.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holbrook. Other questions from members? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You probably covered this, but I just enlighten me out of ignorance. So, being that we're not dealing with public institutions, we're dealing with a lot of family providers and different providers. What happens to that data once that NP? Because I know that there's a lot of folks that come into this field and go out of this field. Is there any instructions or any restrictions on what happens to that data after they go out of business? Where does that data go? How is that data handled?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, I can't actually answer in all cases what they're going to do with it. The obligation of keeping it confidential would suggest that they have to destroy it or return it to some other entity without using it or dispersing it to somebody else. I mean, that's the basic concept. It's not supposed to get in someone else's hands. And so the obligation to treat it in a confidential manner is not unlike lots of other information those child care providers are going to collect on all sorts of kids who come into their program. But, you know, whether it's CCAP funds or just private pay, they're collecting information. And there is an obligation to keep that information from being spread to the neighborhood.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my concern is if we needed additional language, because it's not a public institution, should we not put something in there to guide those folks or to reference that? Because it's not a public institution, and I just got concerns that data is not going to be held as we intend it to be held, and that's my concern because we are dealing with family practitioners.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, you know, child care and preschool programs is a major industry in the state. People come in and out of it all the time. They handle medical information. They handle all sorts of things that are far more confidential in nature than the kind of data we're anticipating in these applications. So you may, and I don't have an answer for how the industry regulates its own confidential data, except that the language in 4.13 to 4.14 does at least put legal responsibility on the provider to ensure that the information is not released. And frankly, you know, if you have a child, as I do, in a private preschool program at our church, and we're providing medical information, releases, all sorts of things to them, and I don't ever recall signing a confidentiality agreement of any kind with them. So my presumption is that this is an issue that is already dealt with in the industry and probably by regulation similar to the language here. But at least this language is here requiring that these program participants keep it confidential.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll go back to a comment that I made in another committee, is that my concern is on that same part that you brought up on 4.13 and 4.14, is that that indicates that the participant provider is liable for that damages resulting from improper release of student identification number under this subsection. My concern is that they're not the only ones with that student identification number, yet you're holding them liable. And as we've had discussions in other committees about other bills, that he who does the crime or releases the information should be held liable. This looks like it captures them on any release and makes them liable. I think somehow that should be, you know, it looks like the finger gets pointed at the participating provider regardless of who's responsible for releasing the data.
Representative
Winkler. Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, if you would be more comfortable with correcting that language, we could do so. I'd say that from a lawyer's point of view, an interpretation of that language that would hold the provider responsible for somebody else's release of the data is kind of an absurd result and would not be used as a way to interpret this language. But if you're not comfortable with that, we could change that. And I'd be happy to work with you and Representative Holberg. This has to go to K-12 Finance. And if the language can be improved, I'd be happy to work with you on that.
Any other questions from members? Representative Howland, if you could follow up with Representative Winkler on that between now and K-12 Finance. Did I already answer the public testimony on this? Okay. Representative Winkler has moved that House File 1058 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Education Finance. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Winkler. Representative Holberg, are you ready to go on House File 183? Representative Holberg moves that House File 183 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Do you have a DE1 amendment, Representative Holberg?
Mr. Chair, I do.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might move the DE1 amendment, House File 183, to get it in the shape I'd like to discuss.
Okay, Representative Holberg has made the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Do your bill as amended, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sure there's plenty of people that want to testify on this, and the Section 1 of the bill is probably going to draw the most fire, and it's related to access by data subjects to find out who has had access to the information about them. And as it's written, it is... still needs some work. We certainly, in this language here in front of you, say that undercover law enforcement officials or active investigative data, the information would not be available to the data subject, but there are other protections that probably have to be made, and the language as written is probably too cumbersome to be managed across the whole system. That being said, one of the basic precepts of good data practices policy is that an individual has the right to know what information is being collected and how it's being used. And I think there should be some accountability with the system, but I will fully admit at the onset that Section 1 needs more work. The Section 2 of the bill... is asking that policies be implemented as far as access to data, and some of this comes as a result of recent stories in the news about massive access to individuals' information. What is apparent is in many instances a complete lack of oversight, and this bill is trying to get a handle on some of those issues. Then it also requires that Section 3 of the bill requires that if there is a breach of security, that there a report be done, that the results of the report be posted. If disciplinary action was necessary, what the disciplinary action was, and if there wasn't any disciplinary action, the reason for that as well. I did have representatives in my office yesterday afternoon from labor organizations, and they raised concern about this section of the bill, that there could be an appeal process guaranteed to employees, and that they are looking for language in this bill that would make sure that the release of the individual employee's name was not required until all appeal processes had been exhausted, and I agreed to that. I just haven't seen any proposed language from them yet on that particular issue. And the fourth section, or the fifth section of the bill, is a recommendation by the legislative auditor. They recently did an audit of law enforcement databases and submitted that they thought that the agencies that are submitting information to the CBERS database be public. So not the information itself, but how many agencies are working with that particular database. And I'm happy to stand for questions, and I know there's probably a whole slew of people that want to testify.
If there are, Representative Holberg, then I think we'll take testimony before we go to questions. So the only person I have on my list is Keith Carlson, Executive Director of Minnesota Intercounty Association. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members, I am Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I'm also appearing on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Counties, Minnesota Counties. First, I want to thank Representative Holberg for her amendment. Generally, sections 2, 3, and 4, we are in general agreement with the provisions there. And I have just seen section 5 for the first time. I will defer to our friends in law enforcement to identify any potential concerns. As Representative Holberg indicated, we do have substantial concerns with Section 1, the new language that starts on lines. The new language. I'm sorry, I don't have the new language that starts on lines 1.16. This is far more expansive than the issues that the committee is familiar with that exist with the Department of Public Services Driver and Vehicle Services database. This applies to every bit of private data that is administered by state and local government in Minnesota, and literally would be a nightmare for us to administer. Now, you may hear from advocates for data privacy that it does not impose any new obligations, that we are not required under the general tenets of the data practices law to create data. But I frankly ask you rhetorically, how stupid is it to create a premise that an individual can come in and ask, which of your employees have been asking for my private data, and then we turn around, yes, you can ask that, but no, we can't tell you that because we don't know, which is the truth in many instances. Many of our more antiquated systems just do not track on an employee-by-employee basis who is accessing private data. In many instances, we're still dealing with paper records, and we don't have any procedures because we are not obligated under current law to track individual employees. And let me give you several examples of that. Every piece of personnel data that we have contains private data. So every person in our human resources departments are accessing private data on a routine basis daily, literally dozens if not hundreds of times. We would have to establish procedures to log that access to really substantially comply with this. Every time people at our service counters receives an application for a driver's license renewal, a new driver's license, a motor vehicle license renewal, they are looking at private data because the name on that application under current law is private data. We have no routine procedures to log who actually accepted that data. Every individual who administers welfare, whether it's a financial worker who's determining the qualifications for the individual to receive that, or social workers who serve the specific needs, are dealing with private data, as well as our corrections officers, our public health nurses, the individuals who enforce child support. Collections, all of them deal with private data on a routine basis, and again, we do not have systems in place that routinely track this data. So again, I would suggest to you that this is impossible to comply with currently. To effectively comply with it will cost literally millions of dollars for state and local government to put in place the systems that will allow us to literally meet what is the so-called obligation here. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Carlson. Are there questions specifically for Mr. Carlson that members have? Representative Liebling, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, frankly, your testimony kind of scares me. And maybe that was Representative Holberg's point in putting this in. I don't know. But I get your point about no systems are in place. But it makes me wonder, going forward, as we change to more, you know, we're getting more systems that are more capable of tracking data. And I know in a lot of institutions, for example, at the Mayo Clinic, everybody who accesses a medical record, there is a tracking on that. So that if my husband goes and accesses my record, so it will be flagged as an improper access. And somebody will, you know, tap him on the shoulder and say, "What the heck?" So I just wonder if going forward, this isn't something that we should be looking at every time we update a system and go electronic and start gathering more data and making it more usable in more places. So I guess I'd like to hear your comment on that because, you know, I do hear the point that if we were to say this that it would be darn near impossible to do, but that's retrospectively. I wonder about going forward if we shouldn't be saying everybody's got to start building this in.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I could not agree with you more, and in fact that is what is happening right now. Again, the focus of all the angst that has been culminated in this bill, the driver and vehicle services database. Right now, we know after the fact when our employees have been accessing the database on an unauthorized basis. The department has certain thresholds where they flag individuals, I believe it's either 50 or 100, who are making unusual levels of accesses to the database, and they send that information back to the initiating agency so they can follow up to see whether it. But the point is, we do not know at real time when those unauthorized access. The department is in the process of updating that system and hopes to be able to provide that sort of system real-time sort of monitoring a few years down the road. I will also point out to many of our individual counties, local governments are updating their systems, particularly in the criminal justice area. But still, the technology is such that we can perhaps track the squad car that initiated a access to again using the driver and vehicle services database. It does not identify the individual because during each shift the individual who is using that car changes. And in fact, if there's double staffing and that, we cannot tell even during that shift who was the one who accessed that. So we still are somewhat reliable on manual processes. Again, the bottom line, as we go forward, as we put, we are upgrading our systems or creating systems where manual processes exist right now, we are putting those capabilities in place. But literally, there are hundreds of types of records that we deal with where that tracking does not exist currently.
Representative Simon.
This isn't for Mr. Carlson in particular, but I just want to say, Representative Holberg, I think the best part of this bill is Section 3. I think the new definition of the data breach is much needed. It's sort of surprising that this wasn't done a while ago. So I think that's the best part, and I'm wondering whether, as to Section 1, at least in the interim, as we're gearing up towards kind of the world that Representative Liebling says that we should aspire to, where we can have the kind of Mayo-like tracking, if we assuming we don't have that yet, and we don't have the capability to do that yet, particularly as to all governments. I mean, maybe the state could, maybe some counties could, but, you know, Hopkins City Hall that I represent probably doesn't have the sophistication to figure out you know, exactly which individuals touch this, and since the Data Practices Act applies to all government, what about something in Section 1, just as this bill moves forward, that is triggered by a breach, as you now newly describe it? In other words, once there's a breach, you get to find out all the people who access this. You know, that might be one way to do it. I don't know if you'd be amenable to that, and maybe we can't figure that out today. But that might be an interim solution so that as we ramp up to the capability to track individuals, at least there's something in place. I don't know what you think about that.
Ms. Carlson.
Well, this is for Representative Holberg.
Oh, sorry, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Simon, as I said at the onset, I know this has problems, but as you heard from the testimony, I think people should be concerned about where we're at in the public sector versus the private sector. The incident at the DNR, Mr. Carlson's right, they're flagging the top 50 users on a weekly or daily basis, and that system did not flag the DNR situation in which over 17,000 records involving over 7,000 people. So what we have in place, even, you know, as he holds up as the example of how some of this audit is done, is woefully lacking. And I was first elected in 1998, 99. All we heard about was Y2K and how we had to upgrade everything. The world was going to come to end. I shudder to think the amount of money that we have spent on computer systems within state and local government in the 15 years that I've been here, and to find out that we're sitting here in 2013 with computer systems in the public sector that are basically working in the Stone Age related to data on individuals, of which some organizations hold some of the most highly protected and sensitive information, and we have just really not even address this issue in any way, shape, or form, to me is shocking. And I know, like I said at the onset, Section 1 has major problems, but I think we, as public policymakers, need to have the discussion, what level of accountability do we want to have within these systems, and what rights should individuals have to know what their government is doing with their information. Looking around the room, I'm probably going to be at one end of the spectrum. Some of you will be at another end of the spectrum. But I think as a matter of public policy, we need to start talking about this and communicating with those that are implementing our laws that this is important.
Simon.
Just to follow up, and I knew you and I have talked about this before, we need to strike the right balance here. I think your bill goes a long way towards striking it. You know, government is in a tough spot in Minnesota with our Data Practices Act because they get penalties if they disclose too much, and they also get penalties if they disclose too little. And look, I'm the one who, I carried the bill to increase the penalty from $10,000 to $15,000 per incident, so I'm not a softie on that. but that's pretty severe, but I appreciate their dilemma. They get sued if they release stuff, and then if they hold on to stuff that that somebody in the public says they have the right to, they also get sued. So they are also, at all levels of government, trying to find the right balance. You know, if they disclose too much, someone's mad at them. If they keep stuff back, someone else is mad at them. And I appreciate, particularly in Section 3, that you're trying to strike that balance.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, and this is to Mr. Carlson's comments. You know, as I read Section 1, I guess my question to you is there any obligation to have real-time access if they don't know who has obtained access to those records? Obviously, they can't provide the information. I mean, this doesn't necessarily assume a huge huge new burden. And just my other general comment is, you know, our job is to set standards for people to meet. We do that in all sorts of ways. You know, it is not exactly on point, but we set a renewable energy standard and expect industry to figure out a way to do it. I think we have to set a very high standard on data privacy and data protection for government at all levels and expect them to figure out a way to meet it, because we do it in the medical sector, and it's not just the Mayo Clinic who has that system. My mother works at a hospital in Bemidji, you know, not exactly a destination medical center unless you live in northwestern Minnesota, and they have the same system. The medical industry has figured it out because the government has demanded it, and I don't see that this is in any way different. So, you know, just to the way that Section 1 would work, I wonder if you could describe your intention as to what the obligations are of government entities to provide this information.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and you're right. To the extent that data doesn't exist, you can't be required to disclose it. But, I mean, they make a fair point. It's for the local entities. This is breathtaking in its scope. If they interpret it that, you know, you would have to be able to provide that information. But, again, I just want to be very clear that it needs additional work. I would look to the members of this committee to provide some feedback as to where they think we should go around the public policy around this issue. I think there's probably more people that want to testify against it as well.
Okay. Are there any other questions specifically for Mr. Carlson? Or somehow, yours is for specific for Mr. Carlson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, you know, I entered the fire marshal's office back in 1992, and everything was paper back in our files, tracking all the buildings and all the tenants in all these buildings and exactly what orders we wrote on them. And we were required, I look at this thing and I go, we had to take a little out file and write out who had the file, and we slid it in there when that file came out. I don't see that tracking those people going into that file would be any more difficult if they're in an antiquated system that I entered back in 1992 as that. So you could have a little red file that says out that slides in there. Would that not comply with the intent of this current bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, it would in the case of existing files. But again, the mere receipt of an application, such as a driver's license renewal, a motor vehicle license renewal, that name on that application is private data under current law. The only tracking that I think many service counters do is basically the cash register to process the payment that accompanies that, unless the individual has to, you know, basically generate a bill for an individual who shows up without his or her statement from the Department of Public Safety. Again, there are thousands of documents that we process, whether we're cities, counties, school districts, or the state every day, where there's not logging at the front end like that. And again, the problems that are created by the basic tenet of the data privacy law that everything is public, but, you know, for example, generally a name of an individual would be public, but again, the exception is on a driver's or vehicle license renewal, the name of an individual is private. We would have to go, we certainly train our employees of that, but we have not created the logging that would be required to do that. And it goes beyond just saying who's accessing a file. It's would be saying who processed this particular application. We do not have that logging. We don't have automated processes to do that right now.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I find that a little hard to believe just on a financial tracking because they're going to get a payment, and I'd have to believe just to make sure that the dollars don't disappear, that they know who took that transaction and where that money went, who's operating the till at the time that that came through. So I appreciate your input, but I just can't believe that those things aren't in place at the current time. Thank you.
Representative Ussor, is your question for Mr. Carlson specifically?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I'm wondering if the language on, it's on line 1.17, where it says an individual has access to the name of persons who have obtained access. If that said instead who may have obtained access, would that give enough wiggle room to the small entities that don't have you know, sophisticated computer tracking of who's logging something, and at the same time provide some incentive for organizations to kind of get their data under control?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, that would be helpful, but the result of that would be, to the extent that the local government has a service counter where they perform deputy register functions, they would basically say every employee in that department possibly accessed your department. If you happen to be a homeowner who, or any property owner, frankly, we would say everybody in our property records department would possibly have had access to that data, and so on and so on. I'm not sure it really meets the objective of being able to identify the specific individual. What it does tell the people is what they probably already know, is that government is accessing private data on a routine basis, and that a number of employees within that entity may on some point in time have access to record for that individual.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking that it would provide a little bit of incentive at least for local governments and whoever to kind of get their processes under control, so that if they have a request of who has access, they would actually be able to say that we kept this in this locked file cabinet, or these people had access and not, you know, the entire building. Do you think that would be helpful?
Ms. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I don't dispute that it creates the incentive, but it will cost money, substantial money, to set up those processes that do not exist currently, either in new or improvements to existing software, possibly automating what are currently manual processes, or creating the logs, which will take time, both in creating them and then providing that the individual logs each access to the particular records every time he or she accesses it.
Are there other members of the audience who would like to be heard and testify on House File 183 as amended?
And Mr. Chair, if I might, we heard about all of the costs about complying with this type
Mr.
of
Carlson,
policy.
Don't go anywhere for a second. Representative Scott has a question for you. I'm sorry, say that again, Representative
Holbrook. Sorry. We heard about all the costs to local government, et cetera, and I'm not disputing that compliance would have some costs, but I think that in the next year or so, it's going to be staggering the amount of cost to local governments that's going to be paid out relative to some of the breaches that have occurred.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I seem to recollect, and my first term I was on the Transportation Committee, and it seems to me that DPS was investing a significant amount of money to update their systems. And why in the world would they not have put something in as simple and as usual as just typing something in to say that I'm the person using this station?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, the representative of the department is right here. Oh. I'll just tell you that they're in the process of upgrading the system right now. It's a four-year process. The system will not totally be up until...
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. We have, in response to your question, Representative, we know who accesses our data. And we flag potential misuse, and we let the local unit of government know that they should investigate that and take appropriate action. So I feel compelled to testify. Now, my testimony is about specifically about the driver and vehicle information system, which is the subject, that and cybers, which is operated by the BCA, of the legislative auditor's report. So we have user agreements with people who access the DBS system. We know who's accessing it, who they're accessing. We have all of that information. The frustration that I have and why I felt compelled to talk is that so much of this is about management of your employees that have access to the system. Mm-hmm. I have been Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety since 2004, and we have been ringing the bells and ringing the chimes with our partners to say, don't use this data system for anything other than official duties. And when people sign in to the system, when they have access to it and have a user agreement with us, they have to check a box that says, I am certifying that I'm only accessing this information for my official duties. So, and still, we have people that misuse the system. And let me talk just a little bit about the Department of Natural Resources person. Representative Holberg is correct. We did not flag that person. And perhaps shame on us. He was a high user, but this person was a law enforcement officer who was in charge of data practices and data practices training for his officers in the Department of Natural Resources. So, in putting this in context, I think it was reasonable to assume that this person would be carrying out his official duties in a responsible manner. So again, you can hear a little frustration in my voice. I think we tend to focus on the systems, and why can't we track everything through the systems? We can track who's accessed. We know who's accessed. We tell local units of government all the time, train your employees, manage your employees, have proper oversight of your employees. There's only so much that we can do. And when a law enforcement officer has access to that data by the nature of his or her job, we cannot look over their shoulder every time they access it and make sure they're not accessing something inappropriately. That's up to the local unit of government. So we can go down the path that this is going to cost a gazillion dollars to implement all these systems, and that's true, but this largely is about good management. So I appreciate you listening to my diatribe, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Questions, members of the committee? Representative Scott.
Just a follow-up, and I'm really glad to hear that the system is capable of doing that. And, I'm hoping that because of what happened recently and the OLA's report, I'm hoping that that will start to change the culture within our government agencies so that management is a little bit easier, management of these people is a little bit easier, the people that have access to this data. And I just want to go on record here. I was one of those people who was accessed by this DNR individual. And if there's a class action lawsuit out there, I don't care if I get a penny, but sign me up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson.
Question, Representative Scott?
Just more of a comment.
Okay, thank you. Questions from members of the committee? Okay, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Ellison. Any other testifiers on the bill? Ms. Frazier. Please introduce yourself for the committee and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser from the Office of the Secretary of State. And I am not here about elections, just to be clear. I am here because our office runs... Do you have the early voting amendment, Winkler? Oh, sorry. I am here because the office runs a address confidentiality program called Safe at Home. And it is a program primarily for survivors of domestic violence, but also includes some people who are in the program for professional reasons, prosecutors, people in law enforcement. And the program is for people who are in very dangerous situations and is based upon programs in many other states. And in some of those other states, the staff of the program have actually been stalked themselves because they're some of the few people in the world that know how to find the participants in the program itself. So we have gone to extraordinary lengths to protect both the data, the participants, and our staff. And we're very worried about this language that would allow somebody to know who has accessed private data, because all of the data on all of the participants is, by definition, private data. And if somebody was trying to find out more information about the staff of the program, they could apply for the program. Even data on an applicant is private data. So if they applied for the program, even if their application was deficient and they weren't accepted, they could then say, oh, and I want information on who's seen my data, which would then give them the list of the staff members, which we have gone to lengths to protect. And so we would like to see an exemption for members of the staff of this program. So I have spoken to Representative Holberg about this previously and am hopeful that this would be a friendly amendment. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Frazier. Are there questions for Ms. Frazier? Okay. Okay. Anyone else from the public who would wish to be heard on House File 183 as amended?
And if there's another gentleman coming down here, but Ms. Frazier's comments, certainly we've worked over the years on this issue, and she's been very busy this year coming, trying to get special language in a number of bills. And in fact, I had a conversation with Mr. Gehring yesterday and said, why doesn't her language apply? And so we're going to take a peek and see if we have to beef up the safe at home language so she's not running around all the time trying to get special language in the MnDOT bill and the Met Council bill. And she's got better things to do than to chase us around day after day on all these individual bills.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dave Picha, Executive Director of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I'd just like to testify on two sections of this bill, specifically Section 1, Subdivision B, 1.16. Our members are concerned in that from a safety perspective, for law enforcement officers that may run somebody legitimately, and that individual thinking that they're a suspect in a crime, then want to find out who ran them and why, and then perhaps it could be a safety issue for the officer. What we have done, and Representative Holberg was gracious enough to meet with us on more than one occasion to talk about a remedy for this situation, would be the creation of a task force that would include members of DPS, the Chiefs Association, Sheriff's Association, MPPOA, County Attorneys Association, and the Post Board to specifically deal with the issues in the legislative auditor's report, but also to deal with the issues that this language is attempting to get at. And we're confident that we'll be able to continue to have those conversations with Representative Holberg and therefore resolve our issues with this section. On section number 5, line 6.12, where it talks about the cybers data, our members are concerned that there's limited use of the cybers data at this point, and that this provision might be the straw that breaks the camel's back, in that it's one additional report to then access or use cybers data. So that with that concern, we would again like to work with Representative Holberg on the language and the intent and to hopefully resolve this issue very soon.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Picha. Others members of the public who wish to be heard on this, then none. I'll open it up to questions from members of the committee in general for Representative Holberg. Comments, questions for members?
And Mr. Chair, they did provide a draft of a working study group, and as much as I detest them, we might end up going there on Section 1, but I do want to have the conversation about the public policy as well.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members just got an A2 amendment. This is what Representative Holberg talked about, and this is obviously not within the 24-hour rule, but she talked at the beginning about making sure that we follow the due process for public employees. She has now seen the language. She gave me a head nod when she read it, indicating that she thought it was fine. And obviously, you know, we have this came in late, but if members are okay with it, I'd like to move the A2 amendment to take care of what I think is a very fair point, which is you shouldn't release data about an employee unless there's actually been a formal disciplinary action after all the steps have been followed.
Questions from members about the A2 amendment? We all have that, members. In light of the conversation, members, it is not normally my practice to work this way, but it is deadlines, and so if there's no objection, I will allow the A2 amendment. All in favor, signify by
Mr.
saying
Chair?
Representative Holberg.
I don't know if there's anybody in opposition, but maybe we should just ask, given its late introduction. And
is there anyone in opposition to the A2 amendment?
I just want to know if I would be taking on more water.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you. So to your bill as amended, Representative Holberg, unless there are any other questions from members of the committee, any wrap-up? Oh, I'm sorry, we have questions. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, this is more of a comment. Representative Holberg, the intention of this bill I really believe is important. The issues we have is the difference between electronic data and paper data. In government, there's so much more paper data that even if you require signatures for somebody to look at it, if somebody's going to look at it improperly, they're not going to sign the form, so that part is never going to be discovered. So it makes it real difficult to enforce. We heard people talk about how in the hospital they can flag right away when somebody looks at their data. Unfortunately, when you fill in the hospital setting, you have no idea who looks up the paper form you fill out waiting in the waiting room. That information is not available, who looks at it, what people do with it, but that's still private data. Until we get into an all-electronic world, our tabs for our vehicles, our applications for our driver's licenses is still done on paper. And until we get a completely electronic world, our data is going to be compromised in some way or another, whether we like it or not. How we get to the point where it's 100% protected at this point, as long as there's paper, I don't know how we can do that.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, then Representative Holberg moves that House File 183 be recommended, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Representative Holberg to House File 474. And the motion from Representative Holberg is that it be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Representative Holberg has an A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment, which is actually a delete all as well, to get the bill in the shape I'd like to discuss.
Thank you. All in favor of the A2 delete all amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Bill has been amended. Representative Holberg, to your amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill tries to get at the issue of the license plate reader, new technology that's being used. We don't know in how many agencies across the state. It's a technology where hundreds of license plates can be read automatically, run up against various databases to see what hits there are, if you will, and locate people and vehicles that law enforcement has an interest in finding. There's definitely privacy concerns around this issue. License plate readers have been used for a number of years. It's one of these frustrating issues where they knew they had data issues around it, but rather than come to the legislature and have the discussion before they start using the technology. They start using it, then they the information, of course, is all public. We had stories in the last year or so about individuals going to get runs of all this information and using it for a variety of purposes. That then prompted the city of Minneapolis to go for a temporary classification with iPad, Department of Administration. That ruling, I believe, was released yesterday or the evening before the Minneapolis. And in December, the decision was made that that ruling would apply statewide to all license plate readers, all agencies using them. And they... City of Minneapolis asked for a variety of data sets to be classified private or confidential. The administration gave some of them. We're kind of in a real mess around this issue right now, and that we have a temporary classification of some of the data. We need, as public policymakers, to make some decisions about how this technology should be used and who should have access to what information. So that is the purpose of House File 474. One of the major sticking points is what would be commonly referred to as non-HIT data, information on at least arguably law-abiding citizens who just happen to pass by or drive by one of these readers, what should happen to their information. In my bill, it's a 10-day retention. The range across the country ranges from zero and I think unlimited, with about a third of them being 30 days or less. And so the other issue that I think there's still heartburn is on line, page 1, line 16, the locations at which the reader is installed or used. They're concerned about vandalism. They're concerned about the bad guys avoiding those areas, and that it's defeating the purpose. Some would say that the red light camera would be a similar technology where everybody that comes within its wake is recorded. In some states, there's warnings, red light camera ahead, so that individuals have a choice whether or not they want their images captured for law enforcement purposes or not. So again, that's a policy decision that we need to discuss.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Are there, before we go to questions, unless there are just initial questions for Representative Holberg, I'd like to go to public testimony on this. We've only got 20 minutes left in this committee session. Please come down. Who's on the list? Oh, Representative Neuberger, do you have a question specifically before we went to members of the public?
I do. Just how common are these?
Representative Holberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, we don't know because we don't know how many jurisdictions have them. That's kind of one of the problems with these, but they're becoming more and more popular and more quote-unquote cost-effective. So I think that I'm guessing the number being used in the state of Minnesota will not be going down anytime soon.
In order to better manage the committee's time, I'm going to ask that if you want to testify on this bill, you're a member of the public, please come down and stand where the officers are standing right here now. So I've got four so far. So we're going to have four testifiers. Please take a seat and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Ken Reed. I'm with the St. Paul Police Department. The St. Paul Police Department first implemented mobile license plate readers in 2008. We have found license plate readers to be an invaluable public safety tool. Since implementation, we've used, I'll refer to them as ALPRs. That's commonly how they're called. We've recovered over 1,072 stolen automobiles, located missing persons, and the data from these has provided invaluable leads for solving violent crimes, including helping to locate evidence and suspects in two separate 2012 murder investigations. If I may just briefly kind of give a description, because I think it's helpful that people understand how the technology works. Ours are mobile. They're two cameras mounted on a squad car, infrared and regular photography.
And as the officer's driving down the street, they are calibrated to capture the license plates of any passing motor vehicles, the license plates. That takes that and transfers it into a text file through optical character recognition, and then that text file, the processing unit, reaches up to a compiled file of state and federal license plate related information and then makes a comparison. If it matches or makes a hit, then it notifies the officer that there was a hit, and I'll explain to you which data files that that would relate to, and then the officer can take whatever appropriate action. In Minnesota, the license plate readers, once that comparison is to these following files, the FBI stolen license plate files, the wanted person files, Canadian Police Information Center, which is also stolen motor vehicle files, protection orders, missing persons, violent gang and terrorist organization, supervised release files, convictor sexual offender registry, and immigrator violator files. Minnesota data that added into this compiled file set is the Keep Our Police Safe files, which are warnings to officers, Minnesota warrants, and also suspended, revoked, canceled, and disqualified driver's licenses. In addition, because it is text file based, many localities use it to use for their SCOFLA, for those unfamiliar with that term, it's parking violators that have over a specified number of parking violations. It is important to note that the data captured by the LPR systems is data that can be gained by any person, as the vehicle license plates and their locations are publicly accessible and in plain view. In other words, the officer is rightfully in a position to observe the license plate, and therefore they can be captured without need for authorization, and those observations are admissible as evidence. One of the reasons Minnesota requires a front and rear license plate and requires that the license plate not be obstructed by dirt, debris, or snow is so that law enforcement can identify the vehicle by its license plate and see that it is properly registered and, if necessary, make further inquiry. This is all information that is readily and legally available to officers. In fact, good officers and investigators make notes and lists of vehicles stopping and passing by locations when they're monitoring criminal activity all the time with technology. ALPR technology is simply a modern, efficient means to capture data that is already publicly available to an officer through his or her own primary senses and their own monitoring. The courts have upheld in other contexts the use of technology that enhances an officer's primary senses as long as it doesn't enter into protected areas. License plates on vehicles in public areas are clearly not in protected areas. In fact, a very recent 11th Circuit Court of Appeals decision about ALPR, the court noted that visual surveillance of a vehicle in plain view does not constitute an unreasonable search for Fourth Amendment purposes. Why am I here and why do I feel strongly about this? We have some problems with the language in 1.10 to 1.13 in the delete all. It's language limiting to which data, for example, that we can use. I gave you the example of SCOFLA data in comparison in those captures. If someone was to challenge that in court with the limiting language, we would not be able to provide that as evidence when it was being contested. That's just one example. And the other reason is, other than my earlier comments, you're going to need to consider this, please. In a 2012 St. Paul murder case, the murder was committed 9 days after the suspect's license plate was read and captured into the ALPR data. It wasn't until 35 days after the murder that investigators received information which caused them to look. Investigators received information which caused them to look at the data for this case to locate the suspect and prove that in the past the suspect vehicle had been parked at the address of two other additional suspects, providing evidence of complicity. ALPR data helped locate the murder suspect vehicle in a different 2012 murder case within 2 days, which resulted in the arrest of the suspect. In yet another case, a violent gang member's license plate was read and captured by the ALPR 8 days before he committed a violent assault. 13 days later, a query of the ALPR data aided in the arrest
and charging of this violent individual who had a long history involving illegal firearms. These are the reasons why we support the classification of data as contained in this bill. We've recommended a retention period of at least 180 days, and we do want to talk more about the limiting language in this current amendment. We don't want to settle. Law enforcement does not want to settle for good enough is good enough. This technology is just an enhancement to an officer's own senses and monitoring capabilities, and when it comes to reducing violence, making use of new technology to do more efficiently what we already do makes sense to us, and we hope it makes sense to you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Commander Reed. Questions for Commander Reed, specifically. I have a question, Commander Reed.
Yes, sir.
When officers use existing technology to determine the location of my license plate driving down, say, Rice Street, is that information subsequently searchable?
If we're using the Mr. Chair, if we're referring to the LPR?
No, not using that.
Okay.
But if an officer is behind me on Rice Street at Maryland and queries my license plate number to determine whether it's going to come back stolen or the registered owner is revoked or what have you, is that information subsequently searchable whereby someone under this bill 9 days from now could determine my location and where I was?
In just a general sense, if he's doing it out of, for some reason, your vehicle caught his attention, they would run it. It would run it through the state systems, and that, as you know, from the previous bill, the ability to find out who and when were run is available, as I understand it, yes.
What about the location, Commander Reed?
The location would not necessarily be available, no.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Next testifier. Please take your seat and state your name for the record. Noting we have about 11 minutes, so please keep your comments restricted to the portions of the bill that you have concerns with.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Inspector Rob Allen. I'm with the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. Like me, automated license plate readers are relatively new to Ramsey County. A few of our suburban agencies have readers already, and the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office will be investing in ALPR devices for our use and the use of our partner agencies. The ALPR devices are being funded through auto theft prevention grants, and that makes sense because the ALPR devices are very effective at scanning license plates and running them against a hot file of known stolen vehicles, which is maintained by the state's Department of Public Safety. The system, by automatically scanning license plates, allows our deputies to focus on other things while patrolling and then be alerted if a car that has been reported stolen or if a car is owned by a wanted felon is driving by, or if a car owned by a registered sex offender is operating in a school zone. While the live scanning of plates is a tremendous tool for law enforcement, we are being short-sighted if we don't also recognize the value of using stored information about scanned plates as an investigative tool. There's often a significant time lag between when a car is stolen, for example, and when the theft is detected and when the report is made. Since the ALPR stores data on license plate scans, it allows an investigator to see where a stolen car was parked, even though at the time the plate was scanned, the car had not yet been reported stolen. In my prior position as a deputy chief in the Minneapolis Police Department, we had several incidents in which stored data helped us with critical investigations. In a homicide case, for instance, there may be very significant time delay between the time the crime is committed and the suspects are identified. Once suspects are identified, there may be a significant lag in identifying what vehicle the suspects were driving at the time of the incident. One case in point is the homicide of a 13-year-old boy in North Minneapolis. It took us several months for the investigators in that case to identify the vehicle that the suspect used. According to the commander of the homicide unit, ALPR data retrieved 3 months after the incident was part of the evidence that helped secure guilty pleas from the three individuals in that case. In another case that remains open, the victim of a homicide was not discovered for more than a week after the crime had been committed. Stored ALPR data in that case helped homicide investigators identify a person of interest in that case as well. Stored ALPR data also helped identify a suspect in a very serious case of stalking by showing the suspect's long history of driving by the home of the victim who had received an order for protection against the victim. It is important to recognize the significant value of stored ALPR data as well as live scanning of license plates as a tool that will help solve crimes and reduce crimes in the future. It is also important to address some of the misconceptions about ALPR. ALPR does not keep track of where people have been. It stores no personally identifiable information, only the license plate number, date, time, and location where the scan was made. In order to see to whom a car belonged, the officer still has to query the state DVS records, for which there is an audit protocol in place. ALPR systems also have an even tighter controls over who can do the queries. In Minneapolis, for example, queries of ALPR data can only be done in the Strategic Information Centers by officers who have received extensive training in 28 CFR Part 23 and Chapter 13 of the Minnesota statutes, which cover the rules of data privacy. I also want to address the importance of keeping locations of the reader secret. Let me give you an example. We've had instances where we've had very specific, credible threats against high-profile individuals. In order to reduce the amount of staffing that is needed to protect that area, we use ALPR data or ALPR readers looking for very specific vehicles to cover some of the intersections that would lead to that specific target. If we were to have to announce where we were using ALPR readers, we would be unable to protect the target as easily because the bad guys would know there's ALPR here, we'll have to go this other way. I urge the committee to allow law enforcement to maintain access to this powerful tool and to protect the stored data from becoming public data, which might be used to stalk or harass victims. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Inspector Allen. Now, next testifier. Liebling, did you have a question specifically for Inspector Allen?
I do.
Noting that we have 6 minutes left, please be...
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And because of that, I won't add an editorial comment. But my question is it your position that because this data can sometimes be very useful for solving a crime, that there should be no limits placed on it?
Inspector Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative... That's not my position. I think it's appropriate to put limits on it, and I think the 180-day limit is satisfactory. When we first implemented ALPR, we looked at other states and what their data retention practices were, and the state at that time, the majority of them were retaining data for 5 years. And that's certainly not what we're seeking, but I think that 180 days is reasonable for storage of that data.
Thank you. Next testifier, please take a seat and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dave Peach, Executive Director of Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I'll just address two issues relative to the bill. One is we do support that the data is private. As the previous testifier mentioned, we do support a 180-day retention period. Jurisdiction vary widely in their ALPR data retention policies. The United Kingdom stores national ALPR data for a period of 5 years. Canada retains hits for 2 years, but limits retention of non-hits to no more than 90 days. New Jersey allows retention ALPR data for 5 years. Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office allows the data to be stored for 5 years. Law enforcement agencies throughout the Washington, D.C. region show similar diversity in that their retention schedules go from 30 days to 3 years, while the state of Maine retains the data for 21 days. Our recommendation is 180 days based on the testimony of the testimonies of the previous law enforcement officials in that they were able to show examples of why that 180 days is important. For example, in the city of Bloomington, they had LPR data was instrumental in solving the crime where the individual was dropping debris off of bridges. They were able to research the LPR data, and some 64 days later, they were able to put the suspect in the area of the bridge where he dropped the debris and injured a driver and caused a substantial amount of property damage. In Duluth, the LPR data was used to resolve a kidnapping case that was after 24 hours, they were able to identify the vehicle involved and were able to pursue federal charges using that. Olmsted County Sheriff's Office was able to use the LPR data to solve a metal theft case, and that information was resolved 30 days after the actual theft by using that data. So these are examples why we recommend the retention of that data being 180 days. We did negotiate 90 days with the Senate bill, and we're interested in speaking with Representative Holberg on future occasions in discussing the retention period. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Picha. Ms. Frazier, please take a seat and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Beth Frazier from the Office of the Secretary of State, and we are very, very supportive of this bill and think it's critical that this data be made private. It is very worrisome that this data is currently public and that we don't even know which communities are using this, gathering this type of data. As a office that runs an address confidentiality people program for people who are in great fear for their safety, we are we appreciate that Representative Holberg has limited the retention of the data for 10 days for people or for license plates where there is not a hit, but are still worried about the retention of data for participants in the Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program for even that long. You know, unfortunately, some of the people that program participants fear are in law enforcement. And, you know, we would prefer that if a program participant submits a written request, that their data be destroyed immediately if there is not a hit. And so we would love to see an amendment to that effect for participants in the Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program. So I'd be happy to answer any questions and appreciate your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Frazier. Members, we are at the end of our committee time. It's the intention of the chair to lay this bill over until this evening's committee time. That said, it is the intention of the chair to offer at that time an amendment to this effect on lines 1.9, striking the words must be at the end, and on line 1.10, striking the words destroyed within 10 days of collection of the data, and inserting the words must not be retained in any format. That would make the retention time zero, that if you are an innocent actor, there is no reason whatsoever for the government to be tracking you in any way. So putting committee members on notice of that. Representative Holberg, did you want to make any comments prior to when we return this evening?
Mr. Chair, other than I'm assuming you'll have some visitors coming to look for you today.
They can find me by my license plate, Representative Holberg.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We are reconvening in 300 South at 6 p.m. tonight. Thank you. The committee is in recess. Members, we don't have a quorum yet, so I'll not be calling the meeting to order. However, we will. Oh, that's right. We're in a quorum. God bless America. Okay. Well, Representative Holberg, when last we left our viewers, we had finished up. Well, we had not finished up public testimony because Mr. Gemberling was waiting, as well as Mr. Neumeister, and Major Silkey, but after that, public testimony will be closed on this. And Major Silkey, is Major Silkey here? Can you come up and testify?
Mr. Chair, she just approached me about the mechanics of how the system works and how that would relate to your proposed language.
Oh, to my proposed language?
Amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be brief and won't repeat any testimony. I just wanted to share that I checked with our IT staff, and with at least the existing model that our department uses, the LPR software doesn't allow a setting for anything other than days. So the lowest setting that can be achieved is one day, which would, of course, be 24 hours. For the additional vendor that we're seeking to utilize with 3M, it does allow for a software setting for hours, and the lowest limitation for that would be 2 hours. So we just wanted to be in compliance, we would seek something other than maybe zero so that we could appropriately be in compliance. Otherwise, we would need to entertain some other options for the LPAR use.
Thank you, Major Silkey. And to the extent that this is in reference to my proposed oral amendment at the end of our session this morning, one thing we do not do here, members, is change the laws of physics or software. We do, however, decide what is legal. And to the extent that the software would be unable to comply with the requirements of statute, it would simply make the use of that data illegal, whereby under any Fourth Amendment search, it would not be legally able to be used against you, so whether it's in possession or not. But thank you for your testimony, Major Silkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gemberly?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Don Gemberly. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. One of our tenets is that part of the way we keep government accountable is to have the maximum amount of access to public information and other data generated by the government. We appreciate what Representative Holbrook's trying to do with this. We understand the privacy issues with LPR data. The board would like all LPR data as public, but my board is probably more realistic than that. So what is in the bill now, however, with the 10-day limitation on how long this stuff can be kept, one of the things we think is important is that it have a very limited retention. I know you haven't offered your amendment yet, Mr. Chair, but that was basically the board's position, which is the shortest amount of time possible would be the best. So we're very supportive of what I think you're going to do. So part of what we think is real important in this bill is what's on lines 116 through 118. LPR is not really the beginning, but it's part of the use of technology extended to cover everybody who drives by a given point or follows a given car. On the first hearing of this bill, I can't remember if it was here in the Senate, I got on Hamlin Avenue, which is near where I lived, and I followed a squad car from the local precinct that had LPR readers on the back. And I said, oh, that's what they look like. So they're very simple. They're boxes. So, however, there's some real societal issues with where these things are used, when they're used, how they're used. So to the greatest extent possible, if you can keep information about where and how they're used public, then that will tell us interesting things like whether or not they're used only in certain neighborhoods, if they're only used at certain times of the day, and that sort of thing. We made comments that affect with the Commissioner of Administration's processing of an application for temporary classification. So the log idea is a good idea, and the content of the log, at least what you have now, is also a good idea. So we all have a better sense of what is done with this kind of technology, because this technology is just really the beginning, because pretty soon we're going to have facial recognition technology, which will do the exact same thing only with our faces. And however, given the reality of our faces, it's going to be a lot less exact, at least until some really bright person in Silicon Valley really works on it. So, and facial recognition technology, by the way, is in use someplace. I don't know if it's in use in Minnesota. So as you consider these kinds of bills, try the best you can to think about where technology is growing, because then you won't have to come back next year and try and figure out another piece of technology. So thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Gemberly. Mr. Neubeister. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister, privacy advocate and open government advocate. May I address your possible amendment and the bill, or just the bill at this point?
Well, I kind of gave notice of that, so you can address both.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, for the record, we'll just do the following. The bottom line, new technology. New technology, which a number of police departments have had, is known as the Mobile Plate Hunter 900. They do thousands and thousands of license scans real quick. It's capable, it's sophisticated, but it's quantity. We're talking about hundreds of thousands, or if not millions. The technology is moving fast. Mr. Gimberling, Mr. Chairman, did talk about facial recognition. There is already looking at license plate readers expanding more than the license plate picture. Secondly, if you look at the Star Tribune article, which broke the story back in last year, approximately through June of 2012, Minneapolis had 4.9 million scans. In the month of June alone is 805,000. Now, between those months, on average, they did 4,000 to 6,000 hits, which is to a database, and I'll explain that basically. So they had 4,000 to 6,000 hits. Maybe they stopped somebody, maybe someone was on a list, whatever it might be. And up until this time, they basically have free rein to put whatever they want to what databases. It can be the BCA license plate database or others. Now, out of those hits, if you do the comparison, we're talking about less than half of a percent are hits. So what we're doing, we are collecting millions of hits on innocent people, their movements, where they're going, what they're doing, and the technology is getting cheaper, and they're going to be getting more. So basically, a law enforcement entity could really have a nice track of where innocent people go. So I've always been of the opinion that for innocent people, they should not collect that. And I share that statistic just as, you know, as a real quick thing. And where you have to make the decision, are we going to elect technology, the first of its kind, where there's really public discussion? Because you have to remember, this was funded, some of it by the feds, they got, or through the Department of Commerce grant program for stolen cars or whatever, and basically to be used for stolen cars. Now it's being used for many things. Now, specifically toward the bill. So, Mr. Chairman, if you continue with your amendment, it's a very positive amendment. I'm at the bill. I agree with 116, 117, but I want to just talk to you about what is the Minnesota license plate data file. Minnesota data plate license file, and I think this is a great deal. You know, you're basically saying this is the primary thing that they're going to be using. Stolen felony vehicles, stolen license plates, wanted persons, missing persons, individuals on supervised release, protection orders, sexual offenders, gang members and terrorists, that can be some issues, but immigration violators, and the Canadian hot file records. So there, you know, at least we know what law enforcement is going to do. So, Mr. Chairman, my final comment is that you've been here a long time, and I remember when MJNO, this was where the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association had the multiple jurisdictional database of almost 800 million people. Those people that were around, I know Representative Fulberg remembers that, where they had 8 million records on millions of folks from Wisconsin and Minnesota. Not a lot of accountability. The GangNet database, where there were some issues about innocent people being put in there that they shouldn't have been in there. And now with the DVS database, which also brings all kinds of things. So just by using the figures of where you have a million records on a lot of innocent people, can we at this point, trust the police to do what they do on the million or the 99.5% that there would not be abuse of the millions of records to find out where people go? I think the sheer volume of data collected and indiscriminate logging of mostly innocent people, which this is, of people's movements, it accounts to what I've always said in my blog post and with a number of you I've talked to, a broad system of surveillance. And I think we're going in the right direction with the bill, and I think, Mr. Chairman, the possibility of your amendment just will be very helpful until we can see more where this technology is going.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Neumeister. Members, prior to discussion, I am offering what has been quoted as the A3 amendment. That is the same language that I proposed orally prior to the recess. Page 1, line 9, deletes must be and inserts must not be retained in any format. Page 1, line 10, deletes destroyed within 10 days of collection of the data. This would render Representative Holberg's bill from a 10-day retention period to a zero-time retention period. And I would note, members, that as stated in response to the concerns from Major Silkey, I understand some may say it's logistically impossible to do. But what we do here in this committee is decide what is permissible to be used as a matter of law. We don't decide what manufacturers do. But in the event that this evidence does become available and usable against members of the citizens of this republic, it will not allow it to be used if, in fact, they haven't done something wrong. So, any comments, questions from members regarding the A3 amendment? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Chairman Lush. Been sitting here listening to this since this morning and into this evening, and been talking to this with my fellow members and other people. And I think what I'm trying to find here is some balance. I understand the concerns absolutely for that people are expressing, especially with tracking our movements. Right now, there are so many systems that are tracking us. Your cell phone. I've got an old generation cell phone. It's one of the last ones you could buy before they could track you. But I know that if you have any of the current model cell phones, they can track you anytime, any place, anywhere. That's a feature that most of them can't disable. Most of our vehicles already have some type of tracking device. A popular one is called OnStar, many of you are familiar with. So this information, as far as tracking us, it's if we're going to look at the picture, we need to look at the whole picture, and that's going on every day, no matter where you are. Other information out there, there's so many databases out there for us to select just this one for targeting, I think doesn't equate the balance that we're looking for. I mean, I live in an area that has multiple telephone company jurisdictions. I get a new phone book from a different phone company about every 3 months. And every phone book I get, whether it's from the Metro, whether it's from the Princeton area, or whether it's from St. Cloud or Wright County, my phone number always shows up, my address, some of my information is always in there. Who I'm married to is always in there. And I've never asked them to put my name in there. It just shows up in there. While I do appreciate the fact that we want to be protective of our data, I also appreciate the efforts that law enforcement is trying to make to enforce our laws and to keep us safe, especially in cases when it comes to arson that can be extremely arduous and long to pursue and to get to the bottom of things. I do not favor this amendment, not the immediate destruction of this data. I do favor, and I want everyone to understand, I do favor the destruction of data, but not immediate. I think that if we do try to strike a balance, that we should try to strike a balance, and I am in favor of a minimum 10 days. But then absolutely, of course, have a complete encryption, 32-bit type encrypted data destruction. I'm all for that. But I'm also... I also want to express that, in my personal opinion, I think that there needs to be a little bit of balance here, and that we would take that into consideration.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. Other comments from members? Seeing none, then, all in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. So to your bill as amended, Representative Holberg.
Since there's no additional comments, I'd renew my motion that House File 474 as amended be recommended pass and refer to the General Register.
Representative Holberg has renewed her motion. Oh, Representative Johnson does have a comment. Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, just glancing through there with the testimony I heard today, there is an issue with this bill. Generally, in this bill, it talks about the ALP's position out in the public. Generally, these are not just setting out at an intersection or anything. They're on a vehicle. They're mobile. they're driving around. So on your lines 116 through 1.18, it's going to be hard to log where it is because it's going to be all over town. No, I just thought I'd bring that up, an issue that's going to need to be taken care of.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Johnson. Representative Holberg has moved that House File 474 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, you guys are so energetic when you say that. That was a little punch in it.
Representative, we have Representative Atkins and Representative Moran. We're going to do Representative Moran. You've been patiently waiting. Thank you. We're going to get through Representative Atkins. This department bill shouldn't be too controversial. Representative Atkins, the chair moves House File 647, that it be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. You do, Representative Atkins, have an 813-0313 amendment. Is that correct?
I do, Mr. Chair. That is an author's amendment.
Members, to get the bill in the shape the author so desires, please all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. To your bill as amended, Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, I was just delivered one additional, very simple, technical author's amendment, the A2. If I could have that passed out, and I will speak to it very rapidly.
While it's being passed out, why don't you speak to it, Representative Atkins?
I can read it even more quickly than that. The department and the insurers, our agents, I believe, are in complete agreement. It says on page 5, line 12, provided that the total amount of each or such civil penalties imposed upon an education provider must not exceed $10,000 in any calendar year. And, Mr. Chairman, there's a slight oral amendment to that, which is after the word 10,000, delete the current language and insert per course offering. So, again, after the number $10,000 on line 1.3, delete the remaining words on line 1.3 and 1.4 and insert per course offering.
To the oral amendment, to the amendment as stated, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. To the A2 author's amendment as amended, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Oh. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, back to your bill as amended, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We've got the basic department bill, and I've got Mr. Brickwitty here from the department. If you want a thorough walkthrough, I'm trying to. I know for purposes of civil law, I had Mr. Brickwitty here. All right. Come here, will you? Specific to the civil law, most of this is commerce-related, Mr. Chairman. I am trying to recollect what... there's a couple of penalties is all that's in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, you could just go over there as Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. There are two provisions in the bill, I believe, in the committee's jurisdiction related to the work of the Insurance Fraud Division, which is law enforcement body at the department. And that's what brings it before you today. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Other questions from members about the provision? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Cho. I'm sorry, did you really explain what those sections did?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, certainly. There are two sections of the bill and related to the Insurance Fraud Division's work. One is adding the Insurance Fraud Division to the list of law enforcement agencies that are listed in statute that have access to the Cybers database, which is a criminal database that is used by law enforcement agencies across the state. The Insurance Fraud Division did not exist when the Cybers database was created, and so the law enforcement agencies that have access to it are listed in statute. Since it did not exist at the time it was listed, the Insurance Fraud Division does not have access to it, and we believe it would be a useful tool in helping us combat insurance fraud in the state of Minnesota, and so we're adding the Insurance Fraud Division to it. The second provision relates to the Insurance Fraud Division's subpoena powers. Related to when the Insurance Fraud Division serves a subpoena on a financial institution. And in certain cases, we have found that there has been difficulty with a continuing case past a point when a individual who's being investigated for insurance fraud is alerted by the financial institution that the financial institution has received a subpoena from the department, which in some cases can compromise the case. The change that we're making in the bill makes the insurance fraud division subpoenas work the same way that county attorneys' subpoena powers work, and would avoid that issue in the future.
Representative Scott. Any other questions from members? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so in all cases, do subpoenas by county attorneys, people aren't aware of them searching for records, or is there any standard that they have to meet, or?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, I may defer to Mr. Hearns, who is the head of our insurance fraud division.
Mr. Hearns, do you know what she's talking about?
Well, Mr. Chair, we just did testimony that was going to make it just like county attorneys, and I don't know what that means.
Mr. Hearns, please introduce yourself for the record and answer Representative Holbert's question.
Robert Hearns, Director of the Insurance Fraud Division at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, the subpoena powers by the county attorneys prohibit the subject of the subpoena from disclosing the fact that a subpoena has been issued to the target of the investigation. So this would be the similar language to that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holbert.
In any instance?
Mr. Hearns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, I would have to check to be sure what the limitations are. My understanding is that there are no limitations to that disclosure on the subpoenas, subpoena power of the county attorneys.
Representative Holbert.
I think at least county attorneys are elected. I'm a little reticent to extend that type of power and authority to this division. Just a concern. And then if I might, whose fingerprints are you taking and will they be retained on page 9 of the bill?
Mr. Hearns. Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, forgive me for not listing that in my initial testimony. That section of the bill relates to appraiser licensing. It is federal conformity, which change requirements for appraisers or folks who apply for an appraiser's license with the department. And so it is people making an application to be an appraiser, and that's the background check that is now required at the federal level includes fingerprinting, which the department would charge a fee for that would go to BCA and or to complete the background check, including
Representative
Mr. Chair, in some instances, fingerprints are retained by the BCA, and in some instances, they're only used for purpose of the background check and not retained. Which applies in this situation?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, I do not know off the top of my head. I can certainly find out for you and report back.
All right, and then
Representative Holbert,
if you can justify for us why you should have access to cybers.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, again, I would defer to Mr. Hearns to answer that question, Representative Holbert.
Mr. Hearns.
And I'm just still trying to find it in the bill. So you point that out as well. Oh, here we go. I found it. Page 15.
Mr. Hearns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, the Division of Insurance Fraud Prevention is a law enforcement agency like any other law enforcement agency in the state. We investigate felony level crimes involving insurance fraud and related crimes. So to that extent that we're investigating criminals that not only are committing insurance fraud but a number of other crimes, access to the cybers database is helpful in our investigation.
Mr. Holbert?
If I might, just one other question. This is one I don't know the answer to, so I'm out off the ice here. But do other law enforcement agencies have subpoena power, or do they have to go through the county attorney's office? In other words, they have some kind of check and balance to what they're doing, and it appears here that with this increased subpoena power and you know, that you're an investigating kind of unit, and then you want the same subpoena power as the county attorney. Is that unusual, or do we see that in other areas?
Mr. Hearns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the subpoena power that we're just talking about here is subpoena authority that has already been granted to the Commissioner of Commerce and is utilized by the enforcement divisions to obtain records as a part of their investigations, not only for criminal investigations, but also civil licensing investigations. The criminal investigations that we undertake, we use the subpoenas to determine if a financial institution is holding records of a particular target of investigation. Once we've identified that there are account records at a particular financial institution, then we get a search warrant to actually obtain the documents that we need. So in terms of our criminal investigations, that subpoena power is only used to determine if a particular target has account information at a particular institution.
Mr. Holbert.
Mr. Chair, is that spelled out in your bill that you only had it for that purpose?
Mr. Holbert.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, it is not spelled out, as I understand it, in the current law with regard to the subpoena power of the Commerce Commissioner.
Mr. Holberg.
I'm asking for your bill here in front of you. I don't know what page it's on, so I can't really tell, but is your subpoena power limited to just to confirm whether or not there is an account or assets as opposed to more information?
Mr. Hertz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the law that as it currently exists is not limited in that way. The change that's proposed merely limits the disclosure to a customer of the fact that we have asked for the information. So the change does not change the current authority that we have.
Representative Holberg. One moment. Are you finished, Representative
Holberg? I'm pondering. I'm sorry.
Okay.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Mr. Diebel could address the question of who gets subpoena power more broadly. Staff. We said name the wrong one, but maybe one of our staff could answer that question if you know, because
Ms. Mullen?
I think it's a fair question and it would give a little context to this.
Go ahead, Ms. Mullen.
I thank you, Chair and Representative. I can't answer the question specific to the Commissioner of Commerce, but in Minnesota, attorneys have the ability to issue a subpoena. Prosecuting attorneys have the ability to issue a subpoena, and the court has the ability to issue a subpoena. So you draft your subpoena and you submit it to court and it's approved and sent out. As far as the commissioner specifically, I'm not sure how their subpoena ability is different than that. But if they were an attorney, they could issue a subpoena.
Representative Holbert.
And Mr. Chair, if you know, how common is it that the subject of the subpoena has no clue that this search is taking place?
Ms. Mullen? Who's that question for, Representative?
Anybody wants to take it,
anybody
I guess.
Chair and Representatives, I don't know specifically how common it is, but I know that on a standard subpoena form, that would not be the default. You are allowed to tell the person that's the subject of the criminal case that you have been subpoenaed. But I'm sure that you have the ability to request that they not be told. But that would not be the default. That would not be the standard for how you issue a subpoena.
Representative Holberg.
And if I might, so where's the accountability or the checks and balance to this authority that you're not just out there fishing?
Mr. Hearns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, just to clarify that we don't issue subpoenas unless we have reasonable suspicion to believe that a crime has been committed. So it's our practice to only issue subpoenas when we believe that a crime has been committed and we're conducting an investigation. In terms of checks and balances, subject of the subpoena or the financial institution that is being subpoenaed for the information has the ability to to fight that subpoena in district court.
Mr. Holberg.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, this is a rhetorical question, but if you're regulated by the Commerce Department, what would be your reason for fighting on behalf of one of your zillions of customers at the risk of ticking off the Commerce Department that regulated you?
Questions, comments from members? What's up, Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if financial institutions can still make a request of the court to notify their client that there's a subpoena.
Mr. Hearns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, that would be my understanding that if a financial institution did not want to disclose or wanted to disclose that information, they could seek permission from the court to release that information.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments from members? Seeing none, then Representative Atkins has moved that House File 6. Oh, that's right. I moved it. Okay, I moved it. 647. As amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. I thank you for your indulgence, Representative Moran. Representative Slocum is not here, but Representative Atkins has agreed to stand in for her on House File 131, so thank you for that. Representative Atkins, the chair, moves House File 131 to be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. There are no amendments on this, members. Representative Atkins to House File 131.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and stand in is a very good description. Representative Slocum's knee is still bothering her quite a bit, so... it's a very straightforward bill. It passed on with bipartisan unanimous support in the House Commerce Committee. We did have considerable testimony from a victim of some fraud as a result of an estate sale. And all this does is say that if you're going to conduct estate sale business in Minnesota, you've got to have a $20,000 surety bond, which many of them do already, or more perhaps. But the one in particular that took advantage of this poor victim did not, and she was left holding the bag and completely out her money. And so for that reason, Representative Slocum brought your bill, and for that reason I support it. I'm a co-author and would ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Questions from members? Representative Scott?
I don't know. You're probably not going to be able to answer this since you're not the bill author, but just how pervasive of a problem is this? I mean, you stated that most of them are rebonded.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, my understanding from the testimony that we heard at the committee level was that, in fact, many do already have, are bonded, insured, are not certainly not fly-by-night. In terms of figuring out how pervasive it is, it's difficult to prove up a negative, you know, in terms of how many are out there doing it but don't have any sort of bonding. But certainly if it happens even one time, which it did, that's once too many. And to ask that they simply post a bond for this very modest amount of money for those that are engaged in this, particularly at, oftentimes people are at the point in their lives where they're grieving over the loss of someone, isn't too much to ask.
Questions, comments from members? Seeing none, then the chair has moved that House File 131 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you very much, Representative Atkins. Representative Moran, you've been incredibly patient. Thank you. Representative Moran. Where's my screen? Representative Moran moves that, the chair moves House File 739 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. There are two amendments, an A3 amendment from the author and an A4 amendment from Representative Holberg. We'll vote on the author's amendment first in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Is Representative Holberg, is your bill... is your amendment a consensus amendment, or is this something we should hear from the bill on first before you describe?
I don't think there's consensus on it at this point, and I think Mr. Tuma is here and wants to speak
to the issue
and has been doing some research throughout the day, and I don't know that there's any peace in the valley, but I think we'll have to listen to the bill author and the representative from the agency. And
thank you. Representative Moran, then, to your bill as amended, we'll deal with the A4 amendment in due course.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a department bill which contains DHS Children and Family Service Policy provisions related to contractual agreements with the tribes, child care assistance programs, NFIP, Community Action Agency, and reporting maltreatment. And to explain the bill and to go through it, I'm going to defer to Representative Gary Hosh.
Former Representative Hosh, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Larry Hosh. I'm with the Department of Human Services. The Children and Family Services Policy Bill deals with several areas under our division's jurisdiction, including child care, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, homelessness programs, and child safety and permanency. For this committee, I will keep my comments and overview to the sections that are within this committee's jurisdiction, and that's sections 1, 18, 28 through 33, and 36 through 42. With Section 1 is a child safety and permanency provision. This expands access to child support data outside of just the parents. Current law is that just the parents will have access to child support data when it comes to the permanency planning of the child. This expands it to other family members and relatives of that child in accordance to federal law. Child safety and permanency, I'll stay within those sections, and this we'll jump to section 36 through 42. Sections 36 deals with when an immediate termination of parental rights needs to be filed. This is a result from department language from last year. We included language that would trigger an immediate termination of parental rights when there was a registered sex offender within the home of a child that committed an offense against that child. The language that passed last year went beyond that original intention, and at the request of the county attorneys, they requested us to narrow into our original intention. This will limit the trigger or the need for an immediate termination of parental rights and make sure that it's only when there's a sex offender that's committed an act against that child. Section 36 and 39 are complementary of each other in that respect. Section 37 deals with the right to consent for the commissioner when it comes to a do not resuscitate or a do not intubate order. This essentially follows current guidelines that the commissioner follows and also is in response to some hospitals that may not have an ethics expert within the hospital, employed within the hospital. If an agency requests for DNR or DNI for a child that's under the commissioner's jurisdiction, this allows the commissioner to consult an ethics expert when making that determination, and also that there's immunity as long as that ethics expert follows standards of care when providing that advice. Section 38 addresses trial home visits for a child in voluntary foster care treatment, and this will aid in the transition to hopeful permanency back to that foster child's parents. Sections 39 through 42 codifies several of the recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor when it comes to reporting of maltreatment. Section 39 clarifies the difference between a report and a referral, and this aligns with the federal definition for what constitutes a report. A referral is something that once it is reported to the agency, but it doesn't become an official report until it's screened in. Section 40 clarifies how a screened out report can be used, and a screened out report can only be used to offer services to that family. Section 41 deals with the retention period, and that the clock starts, the four-year retention period for data starts at the time of final entry into that case. And Section 42 clarifies that a report must be accepted when it's made either by a mandated reporter or an anonymous reporter, and this aligns with the Office of the Legislative Auditor's recommendations. The next six sections, Mr. Chair and committee members, deals with the Injury Protection Program. This is outside of child safety and permanency. This is within the MFIP division, the Minnesota Family Investment Program. The Minnesota Family Investment Program aims to place individuals in a permanent job and so they can leave our economic assistance roles. The Injury Protection Program, the best way that I can characterize it, is essentially our workman's comp program. When there is a job placement, when a county places somebody that can't find unsubsidized employment and they place them in uncompensated employment or subsidized employment, experiences. If a person were to get injured or to have a claim, the injury protection program covers them. This protects counties so they can feel confident in placing somebody in a work experience program. And essentially what we do here is we just update our statutes to have common terminology throughout all the areas that affect the injury protection program. We're not changing any limits. We're not changing any practice. We're just trying to have uniformity within our language. Mr. Chair and committee members, that is all I have for the overview.
Thank you. Before I move to, well, let's do testifiers. For any other testifiers in support of the bill, Representative Moran? Is that it?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Testifiers in opposition? And how many are there? Is there anyone else here to testify in opposition to this bill? Okay. Please take a seat and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, privileged to be here. My name is John Tuma. I represent the Minnesota Association of Christian Home Educators. I do that on a voluntary basis. Even though I am up here doing other representation for folks, I do this voluntary. And, of course, it seems like the voluntary ones take more time than anything else. But nonetheless, on a busy week, I'm here with concerns on Section 40 of the bill. If you look at Section 40, starting on page 40 and 41, in particular, 41.8 through 41.22, starting on 41.13, there is language that says that a local welfare agency essentially can take an anonymous report and treat it essentially the same as a report they might get from a mandatory reporter. This causes us concerns for various reasons. Homeschoolers for years have had a very contentious relationship with social services because we were a little bit of odd ducks at first back in the 1980s, and there was a lot of tension with regards to that. Good news is that our relationship with social services has been improving rather slowly, but it has been improving over the years to the point where now in some counties in the state of Minnesota, homeschool families are the go-to families for emergency foster care and regular foster care in a lot of the counties because of the stability those families present for a lot of kids that are having trouble. Nonetheless, we're always sensitive and very protective of civil rights in the area of reporting in social services because we've had to suffer the brunt of, I think, of several abuses in the past in this area. I've had a chance to talk with DHS and review the OLA report. I've had a chance to talk to some national attorneys who are very familiar with the CAPTA legislation, the federal legislation that requires a lot of this activity around reporting. And Section 40, first of all, does not flow from any specific recommendations made by the OLA. Okay, there are discussions in the OLA about some reporting concerns they have. There was a survey done of the screeners who are receiving information, and sometimes their confusion of how to deal with an anonymous report. But there really was no specific recommendation from the OLA on this. The reason we have our concerns with this is a significant potential for abuse by individuals making anonymous reports. Mr. Chairman, you're a prosecutor. If you were to go out and get a warrant and try to interfere in somebody's lives, you would have to get more information than just an anonymous report. It has to either be a credible anonymous report or you have to provide some additional information along those lines before you can go to the next step of actually interfering in someone's life. That's all we ask here. We have a lot of concerns when you read this statute that says all I have to show is that I saw John Tuma out whooping his kid in the backyard, and I'm not going to tell you who I am, but I know it's John Tuma, I know it was his kid, and this is the address they live at. That's a lot of concern that we have that now is the entree into a potential investigation against a family in this area. So we have some concerns. We had an amendment drafted on a suggestion that Representative Holberg had made, the A4 amendment. I can tell you that it doesn't work, and so I would recommend that you don't put the A4 amendment forward because I've been given some information that it just doesn't work the way it's drafted. We still have a lot of concerns with the power that is invested in anonymous reports in these situations. It really is treated no different than a report from a mandatory reporter like a teacher or a police officer. And so for that reason, we would suggest that you would delete Section 40 and ask the department to work with us. I understand if you don't want to do that. This is a late entry. I apologize to Representative Moran. I didn't find about this until Saturday when an intern, a homeschool intern, was reading through the bill and said, should we be concerned about this? And I said, there probably is some concern here, and we would like that to be addressed. I really think it is problematic in our state where we can allow an anonymous report like this to affect us in such a way that these are very disconcerting things when you have social services showing up on your step. And to have that based on an anonymous report is, I think, somewhat dangerous. And frankly, if you have two anonymous reports, Section C of that same Section 40 allows social services, gives them the power to show up at your door even if they knew it was false. So I think the language as it reads doesn't flow from the OLA report, and I think it has some concerns as far as where it goes and the authority it gives an anonymous reporter.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Holberg.
I don't know if this is for the bill author or who, but if you're truly anonymous, then how can you inform the reporter within 10 days?
This is for who, the author?
Somebody.
Representative Moran?
I'm going to refer to the...
Mr. Hosh.
If it's an anonymous report, then, you know, it says you can take... you can accept a report even if there's a refusal to provide the name and address. And then you go down to C, and it says that you should inform the reporter whether the report was accepted or not.
And Mr. Hosh.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, if you take a look at Section C or Class C, the very first line, it says when requested. So that anonymous reporter can still remain anonymous, but request to, you know, to be informed of what happens to the report.
Representative Holberg?
Well, this doesn't even really make sense, because they're really not anonymous. And if you give your name and address so you can be informed of the report, you're not anonymous.
And Mr. Chair,
Mr. Chuma?
And Representative Holberg, I think this highlights, I think, the inconsistency also throughout the statutes. You know, we talked about the data privacy issues and the concerns I had with the rights of individuals here being infringed upon. This statute does have a lot of good protections that you don't see here because it's not in the actual bill for a citizen who is a subject of a false report. And so they have rights and they can actually bring an action in court against that individual. But again, that all presupposes that somewhere along the line, someone has that information. I would have to go to court to force that information to come out. But if it's an anonymous report, it really circumvents the whole process of protecting the citizen from anonymous reports.
Now, if you can answer the question, please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, I'm Christine Borsche. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I think the intent of C there is that if the reporter wants to receive information, they would have to give the agency contact information. This particular clause refers to both mandatory and voluntary reporters, not just voluntary reporters.
Holberg, any other questions on
that? Mr. Chair, is Section B both to mandatory and voluntary reporters as well?
A mandated reporter is required to give contact or give their name and address. That's a requirement of a mandated reporter. What this allows is a voluntary reporter who wishes to remain anonymous, and there can be several reasons for that, to still be able to make a report of child maltreatment. I think we just discussed that there wasn't necessarily a specific recommendation of the Office of Legislative Auditor. What we learned from the Office of Legislative Auditor is that there was inconsistency from one county to another in terms of their practices of accepting anonymous reports, and we wanted to make it clear that anonymous report just on its face could not be, or that a report being anonymous could not be a reason for screening out a report.
Representative Holberg, any other questions?
I'd like to hear from the bill author as far as if she shares any concerns with this or...
Representative Moran.
So So what I'm hearing is a couple of things, and one is that whether or not someone can stay anonymous as a reporter, and whether or not it infringes on a family from that report. And for me, as someone who is mandated to report, is that even if it's an anonymous report, I think it's valid. It should be able to do that. Whether or not the reporter or the department will go any further on that report is, another part of that. But I support it. This as it stands in this bill.
But, Mr. Chair, maybe, I think we're looking for the even playing field here. Would you entertain language that would say that if the anonymous reporter, if the reporter who provided information and wanted to remain anonymous, if it was found that their report was fell into the category that Mr. Toomer referenced as far as being damaging or inaccurate or whatever, that then their identity would be known and that there would be consequences for that?
Mr.
Chair, I think my first priority would be to keep our kids safe, you know, and that's a part of reporting. You know, if we feel that kids are being abused, then, you know, our individuals should have the responsibility to report that. And so I think that would be my first priority.
Mr. Chair, I think everybody agrees that that's the first priority. But if we set up a situation where you have voluntary reporters, you can have neighborhood squabbles, you can have he said, she said, you can even have ex-spouses, whatever, make accusations just to make people miserable and not really reflect accurately what's going on. And there doesn't seem to be any recourse if that's the case.
Mr. Chair, I agree that could happen. I don't know how often that does happen and what would be the result of that happening. But again, you know, I think we want to put laws in place that protects, you know, and I guess we could assume that that could happen, but I don't think that is the why that provision is in this bill.
I think we're going to move on at this point. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was kind of going to go to the same thing I think Representative Moran answered pretty well. But I just wanted to get a bit more information, maybe from Mr. Hosh or the other person from the department, kind of what is the impact of just so I understand, accepting a report, just as I understand it, it just triggers sort of the next, if it seems credible, what happens? And that's what I'd like to know.
Who's that question for, Representative?
Mr. Hosh or the other testifier from
Mr. Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. Once a report is submitted, it still has to be either screened in or screened out. And everything is still confidential at that point. There has to be a compliance to the Reporting of Maltreatment of Minors Act, which do have provisions that if there's a reckless or knowingly false report made, that there are repercussions under civil penalty with that. But a report to an agency doesn't mean that it's screened in and followed up with an assessment or investigation. It's just received, and then they move forward with making that screening decision.
Representative Hosh, can any adverse action be taken against the subject of a report without any independent verification? Okay. Well, I think, members, this is a little confusing. I mean, you can have your neighbor complain against you in the criminal law as well, and it doesn't go to the city attorney for prosecution. What happens is the police come out and find out if it's verified, at which point the police write a report and submit it to the attorney for charging, and the report has to substantiate probable cause. So I don't think it's that different. But Representative Liebling, were you going to say something else?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I kind of wanted to say to kind of along with Representative Moran, I understand the concern about, you know, we don't want families to be targeted, and apparently this group Mr. Tuma represents is very sensitive about that. But in any of these things, we've got a balance going on. Here we're talking about children who are potentially mistreated, and I think people generally have a reluctance to report child maltreatment. I mean, how many times have we seen a parent disciplining a child in what we might think is a harsh way and thought, well, that's kind of not my job to intervene, and maybe it isn't. But when somebody actually goes to the step of making a report about maltreatment, I'd rather have somebody take that report than say, I'm not taking that report because you won't give your name. Because we're talking about a child who's potentially in danger here. So I think there's a balance to be struck, and I'm with Representative Moran on where we should strike that balance.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. Tuma,
I agree with you. I think the only balance that we're asking for is that there would be an extra step, just like when a law enforcement gets a report anonymously, he's going to go out and do some of the verification before he proceeds to actually go to that next step. They're telling us that they can't do that because that's investigation. I don't believe that. I believe that you could take an extra step to try to help verify at least something along the lines that this anonymous report is true before you take that next step. And granted, I don't know enough about this law to say that I am absolutely sure, but it just causes me pause, particularly as a former elected official, to know that one person could make an anonymous report and all of a sudden my life is turned upside down. And then the follow-up phone call is to the press saying, do you know that Mr. Tuma has an investigation open on him at Rice County Social Services Office? And all of a sudden your life is turned upside down because of an anonymous report. All the protections in this statute, the parts that aren't in here, are predicated on the idea that you know who the reporter is at some point. It's confidential, but the court could open that up later if they find it's false. You've now taken away all those protections to that family who may have had a false report brought against them because they have now anonymous reported.
Other questions, comments from members? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make one comment reference to the issue of we had a statement that this rarely or doesn't happen with the false reporting. We in Isani County have a gentleman being charged out with that now. Last I heard, it was about 7 or 8 different calls about neglect. The mother's intoxicated with the children. Would not leave his name. We finally backtracked it to find out who it was. The gentleman had a restraining order against him in a family case, but he was doing this anonymously, and we had to physically go there numerous times to verify that it was false. Now there is a record of that in the law enforcement system with an anonymous call, but it reflects bad on the mother who is doing nothing wrong because of all these welfare checks being done at her residence involving her. So these things do happen with the anonymous end of it. And in law enforcement is different than when the calls are made to the family services section. In law enforcement, we have to document it. Those records are public. On the initial complaint report, those are all public, and we cannot hide those. So it's when it goes to law enforcement, it's a severely different impact on these when it's anonymous.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Other comments, questions from members? Seeing none, then the chair has moved that House File 739 as amended. Oh, well, Representative Holberg, you're not going to do your amendment. Is that right? Okay. Representative Neuberger.
Just for the record, I'm very uncomfortable with the whole concept of not being able to face your accusers, especially when it's anonymous. I know we're trying to look out for our children's best interests, and I wholeheartedly agree. But I think the very foundational documents of our country are, I believe it's the Sixth Amendment, are based on that. If you're going to get into trouble, the least you can do is be able to face your accuser. I mean, the law should protect our children, but it should also protect the accused until the process is complete. And I think that we need to keep that in mind before we go ahead and allow this to move forward. Because children are often used as pawns in relationships that disintegrate. And it doesn't take a whole lot of savvy to figure out that I can completely mess with somebody if all I've got to do is make an anonymous phone call, and I'm going to start this process. So we really need to, just this one section, Representative Moran, with all due respect, I think what you're trying to do here is good, but we also need to remember that there are going to be parties that are going to be irreparably damaged because of false accusations. So that's kind of the course we're setting here, and we need to keep that in mind. And I would like to see something that would at least attempt to fix this, to at least level the playing field, so that you have the right to face your accusers, or at least know.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. I would just note, members, that you have the absolute right to face your accuser in criminal court in the United States of America. But if I'm having a loud party at my house and my neighbor calls on me and a police officer shows up at my door, I don't get to demand the police officer who told on me. Because at that point, if I'm still having a loud party, the accuser is the police officer. It's not my neighbor. It has to be verified. The neighbor cannot go independently and bring charges against me. That's the job of the police officer. So I understand what you're saying, Representative Neuberger, but I think the distinction here is what people perceive as the punitive action. If just checking up on you at the door of your house, police officer knocking on your door asking, are you having a loud party, is the punitive action, then absolutely, you're right. But to some other people, they're just considering an investigation. In some cases, an investigation can be adverse. Like you said, there's one file, you can go to the press. However, I think we're just looking at this a little bit differently. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I happen to have the Sixth Amendment here right in front of me, and it does say that. I am concerned about the example, Representative Moran, that Representative Johnson brought up, because those incidents of the anonymous reporter would be, in fact, public record, and it would potentially offer, I'm seeing a shaking of the head, but it sounds as though if the police were notified and made a call, that call to a home and potentially repeatedly would be a part of the public record, which could be disparaging of someone. I'm concerned about this. I'm just wondering how you feel about what Representative Johnson just shared, the scenario that he painted.
Representative Moran, and just for the record, Moran, police reports of people, police officers being called to your home are already public record. Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I really, really do hear your concern. I'm not sure what you're asking of, what is the solution to what you're asking of, because people can call and be anonymous. And so without trying to sound too, you know, life happens. And when people see things that they feel is wrong, you know, they should call and make a report. If people aren't doing it for reasons that are not honest and police do show up at your house, you know, I think there's a place where you have an opportunity to defend yourself or prove it to be indifferent. But I do understand that maybe it happens. Maybe it happens in larger numbers than I am aware of. And Lord knows it could happen in my community in large numbers, right? It could happen. But I think the intention of this bill is really for the protection of our children. And again, I just don't know what, because I haven't heard a solution. So I don't know where we go to say, how do we allow people to stay anonymous and make that phone call without going to the other end and say, you know, what if people aren't doing it out of spite or...
Protect you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seemed as though a suggestion was made that if that anonymous reporter was found to, if in follow-up, it was found to have been, you know, some sort of a disparaging, you know, something. It wasn't substantiated. In fact, it was identified as false. Then what is the consequence for that person? And that's what I'm not hearing in this. I'm not hearing that matter is being addressed. And especially if that someone has done this repeatedly, you know, that casts a shadow on the person that is being accused or the family or whatever the case might be. And that would be wrong if that scenario presented itself. So what could be done to address that situation? I think that's my concern. I share your, you know, your intent that this could be a very, very good thing and would likely, but I just think that scenario needs to be addressed.
Representative Pugh, falsely reporting a crime is criminal in the state of Minnesota. However, these aren't necessarily always crimes, right? So is there the equivalent for your situation that's affected in the bill? Ms. Borsch,
yeah,
go ahead.
Mr. Chair, one of the things I want to clarify is that we're not talking about reports that are made to law enforcement. We are talking about reports that are made to a child protection agency, and those reports are confidential. They're not public record. A report comes in, and I think as Mr. Hosh talked about earlier, it has to meet criteria to be screened in before there's anything done. We have to know who the child is. We have to know some reason who the perpetrator or alleged perpetrator is. What's being reported has to meet the statutory definition of maltreatment, and it has to be a report that we haven't already acted on. So I think in some of the cases you're talking about, the kind of like the malicious repeated reporting, those kinds of things would be screened out because those would be things we'd already been reported, we'd already made a decision about. But I do think it needs to be clear that this is not public data that comes into child welfare. I think the other piece that seems unclear is that there is nothing in current law that prohibits an agency from taking an anonymous report. The only thing that we are doing in this bill is actually clarifying that. So for those counties who are unclear about could they accept an anonymous report or not, and what we're saying is that receiving a report that's anonymous is not in and of itself a reason to screen out the report. And we could talk about those situations. I think a next door neighbor is a good example of a mother, a sister, an aunt, someone who knows that there's trouble in their family, but they don't necessarily want their relative to know that they were the reporter.
Okay, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the information now is confidential, then those people that make the phone call or the person that's being accused, if that's confidential information, they're not going to be entitled to it anyway. So why change the language to keeping all their data anonymous when if it's confidential, the accused doesn't have access to it anyway?
Ms. Borsch.
Okay.
Why the change?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's not about the reporter having access to the data. So here would be the scenario that I call my child welfare agency because I'm very concerned about something I've seen in my next door neighbor's house or yard. And I say, and for some reason, whatever was my own, is that I don't care to give my name and address. But what I've reported meets the criteria as a report. At that point, the agency screens it in. They begin. There's also what happens in Minnesota becomes assigned to us one track or another. At that point, the agency starts looking into the kind of the report, the corroborating evidence, so to speak. And they do that by going to the home, talking to the child, talking to the parents to see if the report actually had some validity. If it does not, then the assessment is closed, and that's the end. And that information still remains confidential. There's no public access to that data.
Mr. Johnson.
Well, Mr. Chair, with what you just said, there's no public access to the data on the family services side. But but the reading of the bill says the local welfare agency responsible for assessing or investigating the report, police department or county sheriff shall accept and do the report and do the reports. By having the police departments, the sheriff's departments in with that statement on the anonymous, now those reports are open to the public. Because of the initial complaint report, that is open to the public and is public information.
Do you want to respond to that, Ms. Borsch?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that a child maltreatment report is public no matter where it's been reported.
Thank you. Any questions, other questions, comments from members? Seeing none, and the chair has moved the House File 739 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Moran and testifiers. Next bill up, Representative Simon. Representative Simon moves House File. Where is it? Here we go. House File 276, standing in for Representative Dean, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Different bill.
Oh, sorry, 580, thank you. Representative Simon, whose House File 580 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Simon, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This pertains to the Safe at Home program, which, as many of you know, is operated out of the Secretary of State's office. It's a program that offers address and other forms of confidentiality and anonymity to people typically, but not always, members. These are victims of domestic abuse. This bill is already on the Senate floor. There was no controversy and not really much discussion. Hope to muzzle anyone here, but it shouldn't be a controversial bill. There are a few fixes, though, that need to be made to the statute. To tell you what they are, I'll turn it over to Beth Fraser and Secretary of State.
Ms. Fraser. We have an A1 amendment also. Is this your amendment?
It is.
This time? Okay, to get the bill in the shape the author desires, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Go ahead, Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser from the Office of the Secretary of State. And I am finally in front of you to talk about the Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program, not as a tag-on to somebody else's bill, but at where this is actually the main subject of the bill itself. And so this is primarily a technical bill, making some clarifications to statute, either to clarify the way that we already interpret it or to specify things. Occasionally participants or other people will say, well, but where does it say that in the law? And so sometimes it's helpful to have things in the law so we can point to exactly where it says that. And then this does, in a few instances, further expand protections for program participants and their families. So the bill makes some technical changes. One is it clarifies that somebody that resides in the same household as someone who's in the program is eligible to be in the program. So if, for example, your spouse is a prosecutor and they are in fear for their own safety and the children's safety, but the other person is a tough guy and isn't in fear for his own safety, some might interpret it that he's not eligible to be in the program. But if everyone knows where he lives, but not, it doesn't help to have her and the children in the program. And so this is a clarification. This is how we've always run the program, but it's just helpful to have it in statute that even if you don't personally fear for your safety, if you reside in the same household as somebody that does, you're eligible to be in the program. It also clarifies that a person must reside in Minnesota. This is fairly obvious to those of you who write laws for the state of Minnesota, but there have been a few people who have said, but where does it say that? And so this is a case where it would be helpful to just have it spelled out in the statute so that if somebody moves from the state, we can clarify, no, I'm sorry, you're no longer eligible to be in Minnesota's program. The law also, for the most part, does not allow us to send packages to participants, both because that's expensive and not safe. This clarifies that packages sent by state and county agencies can be sent, but that by other government agencies cannot be. It clarifies that individuals have to give us their full legal name, not their nickname. It clarifies that the only case in which participants should give us a mailing address is if they cannot receive mail at their actual residential address. Basically, the deal that people make with the state when they join the program is that only we will know where they live and we will not tell anyone, but they need to keep us informed of their actual address where they really live at all times, so that if there is any question or, for example, you know, the police needed to go and find them, they can come to us and we know where that is. And so this is just clarifying they can't just give us a mailing address if they have an actual residential address, or they only give us a mailing address if they can't receive mail at that address. On 320 and 321, it clarifies that if the program participant is no longer eligible to be in the program, we may cancel them. So occasionally participants have called and said, well, I live in Arizona now, I'd like you to forward my mail. And we, you know, need to be able to say, I'm sorry, you know, you were eligible when you lived here, but now that you've moved, we need to cancel your participation. And then the new language on 3.32 to 3.34 has been replaced with the language in the A1 amendment. And this was this language was rewritten after conversation with stakeholders. Our practice has been to work as collaboratively as possible with many entities, because participants in the program use this address for all aspects of their lives, and so there's lots of different entities with whom they interact. And so we heard back from, after sending it out fairly broadly, the language, heard back from the Cable Association, the County Attorneys Association, the Judicial Branch, banks, battered women's organizations, utilities, I can go on and on, from all the different groups that we heard from, who either said, yes, this is a great bill, we support it, or who had a few questions and we were able to answer those questions, who then said, okay, I'm fine with it. And in the case of the Landlords Association, they wanted us to tweak the language, which we are happy to do and which is reflected in the amendment, and just makes it a little clearer that a program participant's address cannot be knowingly disclosed to somebody if the program participant has notified that entity in writing that they are a program participant and of the law that prohibits its disclosure. The Landlords Association wanted to be sure that that if the building manager told the superintendent at an apartment building, oh, Lois in 3D needs her toilet fixed, that he wouldn't have then broken the law. And so this clarifies there's an exemption if the person lives, works, or goes to school at that address. So in that case, because the super works at that address, saying that Lois lives in 3D is not disclosing anything or violating that law. And then the end of that paragraph allows a participant to give permission for the data to be disclosed if they so chose. The final section of the bill is related to municipal utilities, and under statute, as you are probably aware, municipal utility data is all public. And so this establishes a process with municipal utilities so that program participants, if they live in a jurisdiction that uses a municipal utility, can notify the utility that they're a program participant and that their data should therefore be classified as private and not released. So that is an overview of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Question for members.
We appreciate your time.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Questions from members. Representative Holbert.
Chair, just a comment. It kind of goes with what I said this morning. I actually read this chapter of law this afternoon to try and figure out why you were stalking everybody at every committee.
only you, Representative Holbert.
your 5B language into all these other bills, and I don't see that you have the protection in your chapter, and there's got to be a way, and hopefully Representative Simon agrees that maybe when this thing comes to the floor, we can do some kind of amendment in your chapter that would make it clear that all these data exceptions that you don't have to keep running around chasing all these bills and getting your little 5B language in to all the other bills, that we get something strong enough and adamant enough that that's not necessary, and whether it's actually carried in 5B or in Chapter 13, I think there's some, we have to fix this.
Thank you, Representative Holbrook. Mr. Chair, we would love to. I'd love to stop. I work with you on that.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? All in. Representative Simon moves that House File 580 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register as amended. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Simon. Ms. Brazier. Okay. So. Okay. Yep. Okay. Someone needs to find Representative Sean. Don't worry about it. I found him. Representative Sean, the chair moves that House File 1002 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. I'll move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author desires. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Two-year amended bill, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and we will try to move as quick as possible. Thanks for letting us to your after-hours party. This is a bill related to a whole bunch of groups coming together that have licensing boards for their individual groups. And we are looking to standardize some criminal background checks. I do have a testifier here that was willing to give a very brief explanation. This has made some stops, and this DE1 amendment has helped us get it in language or get it into some common ground language with the other body across the street.
Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I want to thank Representative Schoen. I'm Marshall Schrag. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. I am joined by the executive directors of some other boards tonight, and on behalf of all of the Minnesota Health Regulatory and Licensing Boards, seek the statutory authority needed to require criminal background checks of all applicants for health professional licensure. Last year, the boards came forward with various and disparate plans to implement this authority. We were asked to come back with a plan that was consistent across all the boards. We've met together with stakeholders in the interim. We've produced a piece of legislation that is improved, does what we want, and is consistent. I'd like you to approve this. My colleagues are here tonight with me to address any questions that you may have, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from members? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's a good idea to standardize this, and I'm just curious. We have an ongoing discussion about traveling data, and do entities have to honor our classifications? And I'm wondering, the FBI is one that's often mentioned that has different standards than we do at the state. Was that issue addressed at all, or was there a resolution to that? Or
Mr. Schrag?
Yes, and actually, Mr. Chair, I'd like to defer to my colleague, Angelina, and she is more of an expert than I am on data collection.
Ms. Angelina, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Angelina Barnes, Minnesota Board of Psychology's Executive Director, and Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg. The data issue that you're talking about was discussed with Katie Engler of BCA, and we also talked with Jared at BCA in terms of the data classification. When it went to the Senate side, it actually had two different data classifications. It had confidential for the federal data, and it had private for the state data. The federal system does not have a private classification as we think of it here in Minnesota. private in Minnesota would mean that it's available to the subject of the data. Confidential, it's not available to them, and so we were trying to stick with the respective systems in the Senate. After much discussion with Ms. Engler, that does not work because we changed it over to private-private, and the response from the federal side was that that didn't mean anything to them. So we omitted subdivision 7 in this delete all. And by leaving that out, the understanding was is that the default is the traveling data, and that the interpretation would be that when it comes down from the federal side, they do not stamp it confidential, and they don't give it a specific title, which would allow us then to have it be private data by default once we receive it. And the purpose for that is that we want, under the appeals section, and I believe the appeals is listed in subdivision 7 now, which is the opportunity to challenge, we wanted to make sure that the individual who is the subject of the data has that opportunity to challenge that data by being able to give them what we found.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, then how do you, if you're not using the traveling data standard, then how do you make sure what they give you isn't public?
Ms. Barnes.
Chair and Representative Holberg, we are using the traveling data standard. That's the default. And so when it comes to us, it's coming from us federally, and it's under the confidential status. To them, confidential, they allow access to the subject of the data. So when it comes to us, we have to allow access to the subject of the data the same way under the traveling classification of traveling data. So.
Representative Holberg.
All right, and then if you know, do you know how much information the feds will keep on our applicants?
Ms. Barnes.
Chair, Representative Holberg. I am not particularly certain in terms of the retention of this. We anticipate under, I believe it is subdivision 8, we will work with the BCA to establish a plan for completing these background checks. We also are looking at the putting it as a contingency to have the BCA or FBI look at this wrap-back technology. And the wrap-back technology allows the agency to have the fingerprints submitted, and then that wrap-back technology would flag if there's something that arises in the future, but it doesn't require a retention by the boards of those fingerprint, which is our hope, that we would not be handling fingerprints at all. But this just gives us the authority to conduct those background checks, and we will work under the FBI and BCA standards to follow and comply with their regulations.
And then, Holbert?
If I can, then it looks like that this report will have to be developed by January 1, 2017, and so you would have that year to put in place any statutory changes that you needed in state law before you went live on January 1, 2018. Is that?
That is my understanding. Is.
Mr. Schrag.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg. Actually, the section that you're referring to in the report refers to the report that we would do as boards to look at the fingerprinting and criminal background checks of existing licensees. The balance of the bill addresses applicants for licensure. And so right now we're only addressing those people who would be applicants for licensure. The report and the future part, as Ms. Barnes referred to with the wrap-back feature that we anticipate, is for the future for addressing existing licensees.
Representative Holberg.
Okay, and so then the 2018 is your last possible date that all boards would have to conform to this new standard, but you might see boards getting on this program earlier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that's exactly true. There are, I believe, four boards that are ready to go the minute that this becomes effective, and there are others that would like to take a little bit more time, and so we made it so that it would be January 1st of 2018 that all would need to comply.
Mr. Holberg.
Is there anything in this bill that would allow boards to deviate from current Chapter 13 standards?
Mr. Schrag.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the Chapter 13 with regard to data practices? No, there is not. And in fact, all of our boards are bound and respect the Criminal Rehabilitation Act as well. So determination of licensure based upon a conviction that is identified would be dealt with on a case-by-case basis and reviewed by each board.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, this might just Holbert. Be a copying issue, but the copy of the bill that we have in front of us doesn't show that the bill is in committee.
I'll defer to my, well, is the bill in our committee? Mr. Guerin?
He doesn't know.
I think it is, Representative Holbert, but...
Mr. Chair, I'm just looking at the printed version that shows that it went to Health and Human Services Policy and doesn't show a re-referral.
Okay, well, my understanding is that it is, Representative Holbrook. If it is not for some reason, we'll deal with that. Okay, we're checking right now, Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Scott.
In the meantime, I just had a question on line 3.24 for the author. There's just a dollar sign and a bunch of dot, dot, dots. And I wonder when that's going to be filled in and if you know what that number will be.
Representative Schoen.
Billions. I don't know when exactly that'll be filled in, but that's part of the process coming through. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Scott.
So a fiscal note has been requested?
That's my understanding,
yes. Mr. Schoen.
Okay. Thank you.
If not, it should be, but yes.
Mr. Chair. Schrag.
Hi. Mr. Chair, my understanding is that I know that we've worked on, as the executive directors of the various boards, have worked on the fiscal analysis and have submitted data for that fiscal note. I don't know that it's made it through the process yet, but we fully anticipate that the Finance Committee will be looking at that both in the House as well as in the Senate.
Mr. Schrag, did you or Ms. Barnes have any conversations with individuals about collateral consequences, implications for adding new or different background checks for these individuals seeking licenses?
Mr. Chair, I know that we've had a number of conversations with a group called the Minnesota Council on Crime and Justice that had initially expressed some concern about the disparate protocols that each of the boards had had. They have actually submitted a letter of support identifying okay. this as a model of a bill that they would support.
That's all I want to know. Representative Holbrook, apparently House File 1002 was re-referred today to a committee, so we do have it. Yeah, we'll dodge that bullet.
Mr. Chair, we don't want to meet on Friday.
Meeting scheduled for Friday. You know, I'd really welcome the rest of you to come back on Friday anyway, regardless of whether we have items to do. So, any other questions from members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarification here that we have examining licensing boards, health licensing boards in the language here. As Representative Schoen knows, there are numerous classes of medical professionals who are not licensed, but they're certified. How does this apply to certification as well as licensure?
Representative Schoen?
Well, this is specific to licensing boards, I think, under the Department of Health. What?
Not under the Department.
Well, like a bunch of the specific licensing boards have authority to begin with.
Under two.
So under the section 214, and you know, I think you and I, to be paramedics, I mean, these are the types of backgrounds we probably already submit to. Like a school bus driver, for instance, this is what a school bus driver has to do. And so what we're trying to do, are we talking about certification today? No, we're honing in on this specific group under 214. And if I'm hearing you, maybe you're going thinking, you know, we need to keep moving towards making sure we have all the right people in these professions, no matter what it is. And I agree.
Well,
I'm,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you. I'm looking at this and I'm carrying this forward, and I'm thinking if there are entire classifications of healthcare providers who are not licensed. They operate under certifications such as myself, and I operate under the, I function under the license of a medical director who is ultimately responsible should I make a mistake. So as I'm looking here, we have, like I said, an entire class of health professionals that are certified, not licensed. And I was just wondering how this pertains to that.
Okay.
It doesn't. This is not that bill.
All right. Thank you very much.
Any other questions from members? Seeing none, then the chair has moved that House File 1002 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Schoen.
Thank you.
Testifiers. Last bill we have, members. Representative Hortman, Mortgage Lenders and Servicers Loss Mitigation Required. Representative Hortman.
We have a Dean bill afterwards.
We do not, Representative Hortman, because if we did call it up, then Representative Holberg would have noticed that it has not been referred to this committee, and she would be correct in that instance. It's okay. Stuck somewhere.
I just knew there were people here for it.
Well, that's the case.
Well, who's here for Representative Dean's bill?
He just left. Is that move to amend bill? Yes.
Yes, that bill... we do not have possession of it. It failed to be referred to this committee, so we do not have it. Representative Hortman moves that House File 1377 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to let members know I spoke with Representative Hillstrom, and she did not want to see it in Judiciary. She was fine with it going to the General Register because of the civil law issues being addressed here. Mr. Chair and members, House File 1377 is a pretty simple and straightforward foreclosure bill. It provides that in order for a financial institution to foreclose or any holder of a mortgage to foreclose in Minnesota and take you out of your house, that financial institution would have to establish that they have met the national settlement and all the federal standards that have been promulgated under the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau. Yeah, CFPB, CPB, it's those four letters in some order. And that very large stack of documents that we saw when Representative Freiberg was here that they said they had to comply with, this bill says, okay, if you want to foreclose in our state, you have to comply with all that stuff you said you have to comply with.
Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Representative Hortman has said it. I do want to just recognize the help and great work of the Minnesota Bankers Association and the Minnesota Credit Union Network and the State Bar Association, with whom we've worked very diligently and closely on this bill. This language does reflect extensive discussions and suggestions from them. And I would also point out that we are, if anything else arises, we're certainly continuing open to be working with them if there's any tweaks that need to be made. As was mentioned, there's been a lot of activity, consent judgments, agreements, and various regulations that the banks have to comply with in order to foreclose. I just want to be really clear, this bill does not add one single new obligation or requirement. It simply provides the opportunity to ensure that those things they already have to do are being done before foreclosure takes place, and I don't believe there's anybody opposed to this bill.
Thank you for your testimony.
I just want to introduce my colleague Colleen Daly, and she's here. She's from Legal Aid, staff attorney, and she is here to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Excellent. Thank you. Questions, comments from members? Excellent. Seeing none, then Representative Hortman has moved that House File 1377 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Now, members, we do not have possession of House File 276. However, it is my intention to hear it this week. We can do it one of two ways. We can come back on Friday and hear it, or we can have an informational hearing now and vote on it after session tomorrow. Are the testifiers still here?
Yeah, here.
We can have an informational hearing on it now and then convene immediately after session tomorrow and vote on it, and then, you know, be done. I'm seeing nods, so that's what we'll do. Representative Simon was going to stand in for Representative Dean to handle this. I don't see Representative Simon here. But if the testifiers can please take the seat and introduce yourself for the record. Okay. Okay, so it's informational, so we don't need the authors here. And we're not going to move anything. Okay, sir, are you here to testify on House File 276? Okay.
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably just could, but I'm not the list to testify.
There's a whole bunch of committees going on, Mr. Chair.
Sir, are you here to testify on House File 276?
Yes.
Please introduce yourself for the record. Sir, please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Robin Monahan.
Mr. Monahan, this is an informational hearing, so we are not moving the bill. It will be voted on. We'll have discussion on it later, but we're here just to take your testimony and the testimony of other individuals who want to be heard on the bill. So please proceed, Mr. Monahan.
Thank you, Mr. Committee Chair, and members of the this Minnesota House Committee. My testimony is on behalf of House File 276. I am speaking in concert with Move to Amend, a national coalition promoting a U.S. constitutional amendment to get big money out of politics and to correct the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission. It's about corporations are not people, and money is not speech. I am a Minnesota volunteer for Move to Amend. I was born in Minnesota, and I'm a graduate from a Minnesota public school. In 1964, I enlisted in the U.S. Navy for 4 years and took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. From April of 67 to April of 68, I served in Vietnam with the 3rd Marine Division as a Navy hospital corpsman. In 1973, I graduated from the College of St. Scholastica with a degree in nursing and retired from nursing in 1998. I am a partner in a Minnesota small business that I helped start 29 years ago. In January of 2010, I woke up from a comfortable retirement slumber when I heard the Supreme Court had granted corporations the same status as persons with constitutional rights. At that point, I asked myself the question, do corporations need constitutional rights? Do they need more influence in our elections and legislative process? My answer, based on my experience in healthcare and in small business, is no. Corporations are not people, and money is not speech. I was outraged by the Citizens United decision, but being politically inert for 67 years, I didn't know what to do. But I agreed with my brother that he and I would walk across the United States to raise people's awareness about how the Citizens United decision would degrade the notion of democracy. So from mid-May of 2010 until late October of 2010, we did in fact walk across the United States from the Pacific to the Atlantic, and we talked to thousands of people. 99% or more of those people agreed that democracy is worth striving toward, and that the Citizens United decision needs to be corrected. We did not talk to any corporations. Corporations don't have conversations. Money is not speech. The language of House File 276 is to help move we the people back on the road toward democracy by reserving constitutional rights for natural persons and by making elections fair where natural persons' vote and voice is not smothered into irrelevance by millions of dollars being put into our elective process by anonymous donors. Because of the Supreme Court decision, we need a constitutional amendment to correct Citizens United decision. A constitutional amendment is an ambitious goal, but other amendments that corrected Supreme Court decisions include the 13th and 14th Amendment that corrected the Dred Scott decision, and the 19th Amendment, women's suffrage, that corrected Minor versus Hepperstedt, a Supreme Court decision saying that women don't have the right to vote. Those were ambitious goals. And yet, when we look back on those historic amendments and see what looks obvious today, first, the necessity to correct social injustice, and second, the inevitability of the passage of these amendments on the road toward democracy. You and I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States by, now you have an opportunity to be remembered in history for upholding and defended by correcting injustice with the promotion of this bill forward. House File 276 is a nonpartisan bill having broad popular support for getting money out of politics, ending corporate rule, and allowing we the people, all natural persons, to keep moving toward democracy. Please support House File 276 on its merits and encourage its passage through the Minnesota House. In summary, corporations are not people, and money is not speech.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Monahan. Welcome to the committee, Representative Dean. I'm not sure if you've been apprised of our plot here, but we're having an informational hearing because we're not in possession of the bill, which will happen tomorrow after session. We will then meet to vote on the bill and have discussion. So, do you have other testifiers in favor of House File 276 that wish to be heard today?
I don't believe that we do. Mr. Monahan was the only testifier this evening.
Okay. Well, thank you for making yourself available, Mr. Monahan. Are there questions from members for Mr. Monahan or Representative Dean? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to call your attention to 120 now here on page 1. Line 20.
Mm-hmm.
Article entities, does that also include labor unions?
Representative Dean.
No, I believe that artificial entities are, in essence, things that are created by law. So it would include corporations, labor unions, nonprofit organizations. So it would be all encompassing. Yes.
So labor unions aren't. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, it would be anybody other than a natural person, any entity other than a natural person.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted some clarification. I was kind of confused by reading this over because it sounds like a resolution, but it has a bill number. I'm not sure if it's a bill or resolution, so I just wanted to get House Research's take on that, if I might.
Mr. Gary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, this is
it's titled a joint resolution, so the first line on 1.1 says a joint resolution. It is drafted and structured as a House file, which is normally treated as a bill. So this is sort of a resolution within a bill.
And Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this would require, then, the governor's signature.
Mr. Gehring.
If it were to pass.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, we've been looking into this issue over the past day or so, and this resolution has two parts to it. There's a joint rule of the House and the Senate that provides some exemptions for certain types of resolutions to be presented to the governor, and one of the exemptions is for resolutions that request a U.S. constitutional convention. So if a resolution of the legislature requests that Congress propose a constitutional convention, that is exempt under the joint rules from being submitted to the governor. This resolution before you also has a separate piece, which is a request to Congress to propose an amendment to the Constitution. That is not exempt from gubernatorial presentment. It's sort of an issue of interpretation, but in consulting with the Advisor's Office and our House Research Director and myself looking into it yesterday, we think that this resolution as drafted does need presentment to the governor.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And so, Mr. Gehring, can you tell me what line of this bill / resolution separates those two things, the portion that would require the signature of the governor and the portion that would not?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, so the first piece of the resolution that requests that Congress propose an amendment to the Constitution can be found on page 1, lines 16 and 17, where it says, resolved by the legislature of the state of Minnesota, that it requests that Congress propose an amendment to the Constitution, and then it provides the text of the proposed amendment. And the second piece can be found on page 2, line 19 to 26, which provides that it's a request of the legislature that if the Congress chooses not to propose an amendment by itself, that it constitutes an application by the legislature to enact a constitutional convention under Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. So that section of the resolution is, like I said, line 2.19 to 2.26.
Any other questions, comments from members? Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just come to my attention. I was reflecting on another committee hearing that I attended today in this body, whereby in the bill, the word person was very specifically called out as an LLC, a corporation, an organization, or any other entity. And it would seem inconsistent that this piece of legislation is calling, you know, clearly defining person differently than what I heard today in another bill just earlier today.
I mean, if that's a question,
that's a question.
Well, okay. if you would like to speak to that, if you,
Representative Dean,
Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh. If you refer to line 118, that's in the context of rights that are protected by the Constitution of the United States. So it's specific to that particular clause, I guess.
Other questions, comments from members? Representative Scott.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this would, in addition to corporations and labor unions, not being considered persons. Super PACs would not be considered persons. Bundlers would not be considered persons either. Is that the correct understanding, Representative?
Representative Dean.
You know, I believe that's the understanding. I know that one of the intents of this is, you know, if you refer to line 2.3, it still allows federal, state, and local governments to regulate, limit, and prohibit contributions and expenditures. So that, again, would be to the federal government, the state government, and the local government determining what are those rules and regulations related to contribution to candidates and expenditures.
Representative Scott?
I'm good.
Okay. Any other questions, comments from members? Representative Neuberger.
One last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification, so then entities would also include political parties, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Neuberger, we got that question at last, and I believe, depending on what states, federal governments, or local governments would determine, that could include political parties as well.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions or comments, we don't even have the bill, so I can't lay it over. But thank you for being here.
Okay.
And the committee is adjourned.